cost of education and the declaration of no fee schools. In the year under review, that is 2008-09, we were able to declare some 40% of our schools, that is both primary and secondary schools, as no fee schools. So that's the entire quintile 1 and quintile 2 set of schools. What is important to note, Chair, is that although only 40% of our schools that are covered by this category, in fact some 60% of our learners are in fact in these schools, and they are therefore benefiting from the no fee policy. So some 60% of children attending school in South Africa should have no obligations at all in respect of fee payment. And that clearly has helped enormously around access issues has benefited, I think, those poorest families. So a very important move there. Of course, we're continuing to expand it in the current year. We've moved that up to 60% of our schools, quintiles 1, 2, and 3, and we would continue to look at that rollout. I think what's interesting here, Chair, is that many countries adopt an approach that talks about free primary education. Many of them have gone and said, let's just have universal free primary education, and secondary, we can see what we do. We've taken a very different approach in this country, where we have said it's about primary, about poorer children, whether they're in primary or secondary schools, should be entitled to free education, and therefore we would rather say, let's target those poorer primary and secondary schools and ensure that they are free of fee payment, rather than just identifying our primary schools. So that's a major one, Chair, and I think we're continuing to look at the allocations around those no-fee schools. They have increased dramatically over the past few years, so that's certainly been an important achievement. The second area of dealing with poverty, Chair, is that of the National School Nutrition Program. We really think that this is a program that has been successful, that is making a difference in the lives of poorer children. For the year under review, 08-09, we've had an allocation of 1.5 billion rand, and this has benefited some 6 million primary school children. So on a daily basis at school, we are feeding some 6 million children across nearly 18,000 schools across the country. Out of our total of 27,000 schools, so a high percentage of schools that are receiving school feeding, and while we haven't had the empirical evidence as yet, we all know from the international experience that this has enormous value both in increasing participation in school, children come to school because they are being fed, and of course children tend to do better at school because they're fed. So a major intervention, and one that again we would be looking to expand. If you look at the medium-term expenditure framework, this amount grows to nearly 4 billion by the outer year of the MTF, so a significant increase both in terms of the scale of the project, but also we hope in the quality of the project. While we are proud of these achievements, we do need to recognize that at the moment the amount that we're allocating per learner per day is only in the region about 1 rand 20, 1 rand 30. Now we all know you don't buy a lot for 1 rand 20, 1 rand 30, so we've got to increase the amount allocated, but of course we need to increase efficiencies as well and try and ensure we deliver as much as possible. And one of the very key strategies there, Chair, is to encourage the development of vegetable gardens, and we're happy to say that of the 17,000 schools, over 6,000 of them have now established vegetable gardens. These are supplementing the school feeding program, so that together with what is delivered by the state, schools themselves are able to supplement them. And what we're very encouraged by is very often these vegetable gardens go together with a sense of a cooperative at the school, so that the mothers are not only involved in looking after and tending the vegetable garden, but very often involved also in the picking of those crops and the preparing of hot meals for learners. And that has to be, I think, again, an enormous gain that we've seen in the system, and that has helped. Chair, the next slide, the next line, sorry, needs a little bit of correction. The date there of 2010 should in fact be amended to 2009. So from 2009, we are feeding the quintile 1 secondary schools, the poorest 20% of secondary schools. We will do a full report on that in the coming year. But to say also that as from April 2010, in fact, we would be looking at expanding that to quintile 2 secondary schools. So we would be looking from early next year that 40% of our learners in secondary schools also would be receiving that school feeding. We of course have to allow a little bit extra there. These are older learners and they eat more, so the allocation per learner per day is slightly higher in the secondary level, but again we think it is necessary and important that we do that. So that's been the second major project, Chair, and I think one that helped us. And then the third one, more focused perhaps on the quality of learning and teaching. We have initiated for the last couple of years, Minister Chair, this Kids Up initiative. Kids Up broadly, the quality improvement and development strategy. Ministers have at different times referred to this as our affirmative action policy for poorer schools. So what we've identified is 15,500 of the poorest schools in our country, most of them situated in the poorest nodal areas that have been identified, and for these schools we provide them with what we call the basic resource pack. It includes books, it includes teacher resource guides, posters, lesson plans, all the kind of things that we regard as necessary for a functioning school, and we've ensured that all of these schools do get at least this basic resource package. So even while we might be waiting for further infrastructure or other things, let's at least ensure that the schools are able to do quality teaching and learning for these disadvantaged communities. So those three, I think, have been our big flagship projects under dealing with poverty. There are a number of other areas in the report which you would see, but we would certainly highlight those. The second priority identified by the Minister is in the broad area of skills development, clearly a national priority. And a couple of flagship programs there. The first one has been the recapitalization of the FET colleges. You would know that we spent some 1.9 billion rand over 3 years to get all our colleges up to scratch in terms of facilities, laboratories, workshops, those kind of things. And really I would invite the honourable representatives here to please visit some of these FET colleges and have a look at the kind of infrastructure and facilities they now have for education and training. Really, I think some of them are very exciting places to be, and we need to encourage particularly matriculants who might not get into university to really consider attending these FET colleges. We have allocated an amount of nearly 800 million to build capacity around the offering of the what we call the NCV skills program. The NCV is the National Certificate Vocational, that is distinct from the National Senior Certificate that you get at school writing matric. You can get a National Certificate Vocational through an FET college, and we've built capacity around that to ensure that both lecturers and other elements are in place. And then we've given in the year under review an amount of 67 million rand has been made available. We've awarded bursaries to over 12,000 students registered for the NCV program. This is administered through the National Student Financial Aid Scheme, and these students would now be completing in many cases their 3-year NCV program and would be available, I think, as highly skilled people in the labour market. So those colleges we continue to work on. We're growing each year the amount of bursaries made available, and we'll continue to see hopefully increased numbers of skilled learners coming out of them. You would bear in mind that the Minister of Higher Education and Training has set a target now of 1 million learners in these colleges, and we need to see continual growth in the sector. In terms of the school sector more specifically, we've put a lot of emphasis on teacher development that in part has been supported by the major teacher development summit that we held earlier this year. But the suggestion that we had not been doing enough in this area, I think, is a little bit contradicted by what you see here. The most important, I think, and one of the most successful is our Funza Lushaka bursary fund for training student teachers. In the year under review, it was 180 million rand. That has grown significantly in this year. But in that year alone, we were able to give over 5,000 bursaries to student teachers, either beginning their course of study, or in some case, students who might have finished a first degree, weren't sure where they wanted to go from there. We were able to give them a bursary then to do a postgraduate certificate in education. for qualifying for these bursaries, we require a number of things. One, of course, is particular subject orientation. Maths and science is an obvious one, but it's certainly not the only one. We also prioritize languages broadly, particularly African languages, where we are short of teachers. We prioritize foundation-based teachers, where we don't have enough, certainly there. But this Fonds de Lushaka Fund, I think, has dramatically changed the landscape. Just to say that, obviously, many learners do apply for the Fonds de Lushaka bursaries because they are so attractive. These bursaries, by the way, not only pay your fees, they pay your residence accommodation as well. You're given money for books to ensure that you have what you need there. And in fact, we even go further, we give them pocket money as well. So literally, any student, particularly a poor student, should not have any reason to say, I can't afford to study as a teacher. So they are generous bursaries. And what we find is that many students apply for them, might not be successful in them. They then opt rather to go for the NSFAS loan, which is not as attractive because you have to repay that one. The teacher bursary, you simply work for us and it is paid back in that way. But many students have opted either to go to NSFAS or to find other funding means such that they have continued to go into teacher training even though they might not have got the bursary. And I'm happy to say, Chair, that last year alone, some 9,000 new teachers graduated from our universities and have entered the system. That number is growing, and I understand by the end of this year we will be in excess of 10,000 new teachers coming out the system, and within the next year or two we will be at that figure of 12,000, which is in fact the exact number of teachers who leave our system each year. So the Fonds de Lushaka bursary, I think, has really helped us to reach an equilibrium now around teacher supply and demand, such that in most cases we're able to say there is no reason for a school to employ an unqualified or underqualified teacher. We should have sufficient in the system. In 2009, end of 2008, 1,085 of those students graduated, and they've been placed in our schools. We do need your support, your colleagues. We had evidence in one case where a number of these successful Fonds de Lushaka bursars came out of university. They reported to a particular province where they were now to be placed. The provincial MEC very proudly took them to the school and said, at last, you don't have to sit with unqualified teachers anymore. I've got these nicely, freshly trained, qualified teachers. And regrettably, the school said, no, we'd rather stick with the ones we've got. They're from the local community. We'll have these unqualified ones rather. So we do need the public reps, please, to ensure if you do visit schools, please ask them, are all your teachers qualified? And if not, simply, why not? Because there are available qualified teachers, and there really shouldn't be any reason for them to be employing unqualified teachers at this stage. So it is an issue, and we want to make sure these teachers do enter in the system. They are well-trained teachers, there's no doubt. Beyond the initial teacher training, we have the CPTD, that is your continuing professional teacher development. We've got over 2,000 teachers registered there for various programs under CPTD. Some of them are upgrading programs, some of them are more career specific. For example, we offer a particular qualification in race and values in education. We offer a program in school leadership and management. So various programs on offer, and we are sponsoring these teachers. We also have these 1,789 teachers registered on the National Professional Diploma in Education. That's a specific diploma designed for the upgrading of underqualified teachers, and at the end of the year, over 1,000 of them have graduated. They have now become fully qualified teachers. And then finally, just on teacher development, because it is all linked with issues of OSD, we reached an agreement with the teacher unions in April 2008 on OSD. So teachers there have both agreed to OSD and received the benefits of it. So please also, perhaps we need your support where teachers are now making noises about where's our OSD. They need to be reminded, in fact, they were the first to sign on OSD and the first to receive the benefits of OSD, and that has indeed been paid out. The reason it's linked to teacher development is that that OSD agreement provided for the first time for a system of performance-related pay where ordinary teachers would get 3% every 2 years. But good teachers would get a 6% increase every 2 years, and outstanding teachers could in fact get a 9% increase every 2 years. So it is significantly linked to the performance of our teachers, and that's an important move. And then finally, I think in this area is around the whole focus on maths and science. We have our Dinner Lady focus schools working in maths and science. In 2008, we took that number up to 500 schools as a targeted selection. And while it is a relatively small number, Chair, I think it is important that we recognize that although they only constitute, I think, some 7% of the total number of secondary schools in the country, they produced nearly 25% of the maths and science passes that we received in 2008. So these schools are certainly delivering, in most cases, on the maths and science passes that we're looking at. From the National Department, we provided additional resources to these schools. The expectation largely is, of course, that provinces should be supporting these schools, but regrettably, in some cases, provinces were unable to provide these schools with everything they needed. We had to put in different books and materials and calculators, etc., and that has certainly helped. And, of course, on the maths and science side, we held our first national National Senior Certificate Exam. That's the new matric exam, of course, conducted for the first time in 2008. Chair, just to remind the House here that we set ourselves a target for that examination of 50,000 maths and science, high level passes. I'm pleased to say that in that year we exceeded that target of 50,000. In fact, we got 63,000 high quality maths passes, so certainly that is something happening in our schools that we should encourage. Just to continue with the schools development, skills development area, of course the maths literacy program was kicked off in the year under review. We launched it in 2008. We started with a target of 300,000 adult learners who were needing to be made literate. I think pleased to say that we in fact registered 380,000 learners, but that produced very significant financial pressures. We only had a budget for 300,000 learners. But you do get situations that are very difficult. People report to these Karigudi centres and they say, look, we want to register. It's very difficult to say to someone, sorry, we've reached our limit of 300,000, you must go away and come back next year. So in many cases we were simply saying, look, if they come, let's take them. But eventually when we arrived at 380,000, I had to call a stop to it and say, look, that's all we can do. If we're going to provide quality, we will certainly continue those in the coming year. So we had exceeded our target in that year. And in fact, by the end of this year, we will have graduated over 1 million learners towards our target of 4.7 million adult illiterates that we're trying to ensure are literate. But important to note that beyond obviously the benefits of literacy, in teaching these 380,000 learners, we had some 20,000 volunteer educators. These are predominantly youth, youth with matric, that is a requirement, and that are paid an allowance for the teaching that they do. 200 volunteer supervisors, 150 coordinators, and some 2,300 provincial supervisors. So really a large employment creation there. That number has gone up to nearly 40,000 this year, so significant contribution to employment as well that we have achieved through the Karigudi program. On the higher education side, we invested an additional 439 million rand. Most of our funding historically to universities had been generic funding. We had simply given the universities a subsidy and it was up to them to decide how to use that subsidy. In the year under review, we in fact held back some of that money. And this 439 million rand was targeted intervention, particularly to disadvantaged institutions and particularly in relation to scarce skills area, particularly around engineering, science, technology, etc. This money has been given directly to institutions to build their capacity, either in terms of staff development or in the development of facilities, to ensure that we increase the outputs of people in these scarce skills areas. And I think we're seeing the growth already in the number of engineers being graduated every year. Finally, Chair, on the skills development side, to remind us that the Department of Education was mandated to develop and manage the human resource development strategy for South Africa, and I stress this is not just about public service human resources, this is both in the private and public sector. During the year under review, we published the human resource development strategy. We have had significant consultations with the union through NEDLAC, and then finally through the GIPSA structures, which involved our business and other partners. And in March of this year, the human resource development strategy has been approved by government, and we are now busy with its implementation, and we will continue to report on that. Madam Chair, the third broad priority is that of quality improvement, and of course it's a major one that continues to require a lot of effort. We start with the early childhood development area because, again, international evidence tells us that investments at this age are probably some of the most cost-effective you can get, and that a year of preschool education has enormous benefits, both economic and educational, through the course of the following 12 years. I'm pleased to say that in 2008 or beginning of 2009, we were able to register 700,000 five-year-olds. We estimate the total cohort now to be just in excess of 800,000. So approximately 800,000 five-year-olds would be the total cohort. The 700,000, therefore, is not yet universal. We are aiming at universal grade R education. So in other words, every five-year-old we would expect to be enrolled either at school in a grade R class, or, of course, many children still attend community-based grade R facilities, preschools and those sort of things. But we want to ensure that every five-year-old is registered, and we think we are very close at the moment now to universal enrollment in that regard. But at that stage, we were at 700,000. To try and improve the quality in these areas, we've taken bags and reading books into a number of grade R and grade 1 classes, trying to promote this idea of drop all and read. Every day during the course of a grade R program, there should be an opportunity for children just to drop everything else, pick up a book, and let's read for half an hour, whatever it might be. So we push that quite strongly in various schools, particularly poorer schools. And then very nicely, with the support of USAID, we've been able to produce 2.5 million books, Ituba books, so we've called them. These are interesting. They've actually been written by teachers themselves, so they're very relevant to issues that are being dealt with. They've been written in all 11 languages, which is very encouraging, and over 2,000 schools have been the beneficiaries of these Ituba books, and we're very encouraged by them as well. Quality also, of course, doesn't mean just quality for the majority. We need to ensure quality for every single individual. And, of course, there are many individual learners with special needs that we need to address. So our continued focus on inclusive education, we have published white paper number 6 that spells out our vision for this. We recognize it's a long haul that we have, so even White Paper 6 has identified 2020 as the target date by which we should have concluded many of these things. So during this particular year, we did an investigation across all provinces to check on the rate of implementation of inclusive education, trying to ensure that those learners who are able to participate and meaningfully in a mainstream school are indeed placed in these schools, that they get the kind of support that they would need for being mainstreamed in that way. One of the areas we identified in this investigation was that many schools lack what we call assistive devices, the kind of braille machines that are required, computers that convert text into speech, etc. So what we did to assist there is we went out on a national tender for procurement and distribution of assistive devices to try and help the provinces to procure and distribute these. And then in terms of the full-service schools, we had identified 30 schools that we are converting into what we call full-service schools, schools which would be able to accommodate learners with special needs, have things like wheelchair ramps and other facilities, and I'm glad to say that 12 of them now have been fully completed, and they are able to now accommodate any learners, whatever their particular needs might be. And finally, I think on the quality improvement side, two more items. A major one that we launched in 2008 was this Foundations for Learning campaign. I'm pleased to say now that the campaign period has ended and this is now being transformed into a Foundation for Learning program because it's an ongoing thing. But what this responded to, I think, was the sense that many people were still saying, but we don't know whether we should be teaching our children to read or write or whatever. And the Foundations for Learning campaign, which went out in the form of a government gazette to every single school, was to say quite unequivocally, this is what we expect you as a teacher to be teaching in the foundation phases, grades 1 to 6. This is what we should be teaching, this is what children should be learning, and saying that by the end of grade 1, this is what a child should be able to do, end of grade 2, end of grade 3, etc. We've not limited this information to schools, we've provided it also, and that's why it's in the form of a campaign, to communities and to parents in particular. So parents should be able to know at the end of grade 1, is my child meeting the required standards or not, have they been properly taught or not, and clearly if there are problems to be able to raise them with the school. I have to say the response we've received from schools on this Foundations for Learning campaign has been remarkably positive. All these foundation phase teachers have said, at last, this is the direction we needed. Now we know what we're supposed to be doing. Let's just get on. Let's just do it. Forget about all this terminology, this thing, that thing. Let's just make sure children can read, write, and count by the time they leave the foundation phase. So really it has been a very successful one, I think. And just to ensure that it's well understood, we've sent assessment frameworks for both the foundation and the intermediate phase to all schools so that they are able to assess them against a common standard and ensure that our children are indeed achieving the kind of outcomes we would hope. This has been perhaps supported by the systemic evaluation that we do. Systemic evaluation involves the testing of some 30,000 learners across the system. It's a representative sample of learners. This is something we've done since 2004. So we're into our third cycle now of systemic evaluation. We know that in 2004 the levels of performance were relatively low. I'm glad to say in 2007 they had increased somewhat by 5 to 6% in some cases. We are hoping that in the third round, which we're now conducting, we will continue to see those sort of improvements, and we have set ourselves the target of at least 50% by 2011 that we ensure that our children are at least meeting that sort of standard. Again, we've shared these with our teachers. This can't just be a remote test. It has to be something that helps our teachers understand the sort of standards we're looking for. So in providing the reading toolkits for teachers, we've also given them the systemic evaluation instrument so that they're able to see what it is they should be trying to achieve in teaching their children. And then finally, the whole school evaluation. This is just effectively our inspection facility, as it were. This is a system of evaluation that looks at the overall functionality of a school. There's a guide that schools themselves would use to ensure that they are able to monitor their own performance. We've given all schools a copy of a generic improvement plan, obviously has to be modified appropriately for that. But I'm pleased to say that all provinces have now appointed whole school evaluation supervisors. They've been trained in terms of how they should do their job, and they are on a regular basis visiting schools and providing reports to provincial departments about the performance of these schools. Number four, Madam Chair, is on health promotion. It's all very well that we do as much as we can in the school, but obviously we have to respond to the children who come to us in those schools and ensure that the children themselves are in a position where they're able to benefit from that. So we have a number of programs here. One, of course, is the Life Skills programs, and a lot of the Life Skills programs does deal with issues of health, particularly around physical exercise. We have made it quite clear to all schools now that we expect physical education to be conducted as part of the formal school program. There was some ambiguity about that. I think we've removed that entirely. But also the life skills programs do include, for example, a lot of guidance and counseling around issues of maintaining a healthy lifestyle, prevention of HIV and AIDS infection, issues of learner pregnancy, very strong there, and all of these are being provided through the life skills program. The HIV and AIDS, we have a specific conditional grant. And we have noted, Chair, and although we can't claim it as our success alone, that there does seem to be at least a levelling off, if not a decrease, in HIV and AIDS infections among 15 to 19-year-olds. We are hoping in some way that the programs offered at schools are at least a contributor towards that decline, and certainly it's good news for the country. We've not neglected our students at university as well. We have what's known as the HEAIDS initiative, supported by the European Union, where both we provide prevention and treatment at higher education institutions to students. The big new development has been the Zlatimpilo campaign, which we've launched in the provinces. This really is about an integrated service delivery. We do it together with the Department of Health and the Department of Social Development. We go to a particular school site, but we invite learners and parents from all the surrounding areas to come to that school site, and social development, make sure that the people are receiving the right sort of grants that they should be getting. The Department of Health then provides the eye screening, the ear screening, checks the teeth, and those sort of things. As well as checks that they have the required immunizations needed. That is an ongoing program. It's now going beyond just a specific campaign. This is something that's been institutionalized, and the Department of Health have committed resources now to ensure that school nurses broadly are visiting every school on a regular basis to check. Can children see properly? Can they see the blackboard? Can they hear properly? Can they hear the teacher? Are there problems with teeth or anything else that we need to know about? And have they been properly immunized? All of that, I think, is assisting in ensuring that learners benefit from teaching and learning. And then, as I say, the whole sporting area, apart from phys ed during the formal program, we're obviously encouraging very strongly the participation in sporting activities after school and other enrichment programs. We have the Sport for Development program, and more schools and learners are participating in that. I'm very happy to say that the large teacher union has committed its members to say at least two afternoons a week we will ensure we get involved in extramural activities. Again, I'm going to appeal to our public representative. If you visit a school, please do ask about the extramural activities, and if teachers are not participating, we would like to know so that we can pick that up with the teachers themselves. Finally, Chair, all of this is not going to be possible if we don't have the right institutions to be able to deliver on it. So perhaps on different layers, one is on an institutional level. We have been able to identify the construction of high-quality infrastructure facilities at some 21 sites across three provinces. I think, Chair, we're particularly encouraged by this because historically we've seen a bit of a trend where perhaps we sort of work from the bottom up. We identify the worst off schools, the mud schools, the derelict schools, the schools in unsafe conditions, and we try to address them. But then as we're doing that, as we heard the other day, a school in Mpumalanga, I think, damaged yesterday through storm damage. So every time we sort of take two steps forward, we have to take one back to catch up on that school again. And we keep chipping off the bottom as best we can. And it's right, we must do that. Obviously, these are the schools most in need. But, Chair, a number of provinces, and Limpopo, I know, is one, has said, look, we can continue doing this, but we'll probably spend the rest of our life doing it, and we'll certainly still not be there. So they have said, let's rather start at the top of the pile, and let's develop high-quality, state-of-the-art institutional facilities, schools, in the areas that need them. And if need be, they say, we will move learners from those dilapidated schools into these new facilities and at least make sure that those children are in a place that's got a computer laboratory, it's got a science laboratory, it's got a school library, those sort of things. So instead of, as I say, chipping off from the bottom, they've in a sense now said, let's go for the high-quality state-of-the-art institution. And I think it is an approach that we would want to be sharing with other provinces and seeing if they can possibly look at it as well. But I'd encourage you to go and look at those new schools that have been built in Limpopo, I think are critical. One of the questions would be whether we should be putting hostels at those facilities as well, but we'll maybe pick up on that in the rural education side. Madam Chair, during this year we did publish infrastructure norms and standards. We have to be careful. These, of course, are aspirational. We can't just declare today that every school will have a library. It's not going to be possible. But the norms and standards certainly have set minimum standards for the development of new infrastructure. So any new school built, we know, should be compliant with these norms and standards. For the rest of them, obviously, we need to move progressively towards the achievement of these norms and standards. But they have helped us to understand what is a school, how do we define it, size, and shouldn't be smaller than this, shouldn't be bigger than that, those kind of things that are starting to give order, I think, to our system. And just to say, we have election guidelines also for SGBs. We had our last election in this current year under review, so this is now preparation for the next elections in 3 years' time. We've done a lot of work on district development, Madam Chair, and that has been, I think, a gap in the system. We have legislation around national and provincial departments. We have legislation around the schools. But, in fact, the instrument for delivery of so much of these things is, in fact, the district. And we have very different practices across all our districts in terms, again, of size, function, shape, and all of that. So we've now developed a draft policy on the roles and responsibilities of a district. What should a district look like? How many schools should it cover? What sort of function should it perform? And what sort of resources does it need to do that? And hopefully this will lead more and more to a harmonization across provinces of both the structures, the job descriptions, etc., of our district. The FET colleges I've spoken a bit about, but just to say there, we've also worked on the whole area of student support services. I'm glad to say that every FET college now has a student support service centre that is providing them with career guidance. We've given information around the bursaries. These have been provided to schools around the country to encourage learners to consider FET college as an option. We put further information on our website on the Tutong portal, which is our education portal, and published a national register of private FET colleges. One of the things our people continue to be, I'm afraid, caught by is they register with colleges that are regrettably just cash institutions, and we do encourage any learner before they go and sign up for a private FET college, please just check on the department website, is this college registered or not? If it's not registered, we cannot be held responsible for the quality of the work that's been offered there or the qualifications that are provided by it. FET colleges also, the Minister of Finance has given concurrence on the norms and standards for FET college funding, and more and more that will be moving into a national function. And higher ed really is a support function there. It's support around regulation, it's support around academic and research programs, as well as institutional structures, particularly the governing councils of our higher ed institutions. Chair Pat, just a couple of other highlights that I think it would be amiss not to mention. One is the enormous work that we've done through Africa. Our Minister of Education at the moment, in fact, is chair of what's known as the Council of Ministers of Education in Africa, COMEDAF. That's the structure under the African Union. We chair that structure at the moment. We'll be going to Kenya in the next couple of weeks for that conference. But apart from that, we have very good relations with many countries in Africa. And one of the things that many people don't know is that for our SADC countries, our neighboring countries, all of them qualify for local fees at our higher education institutions. We have some 50,000 students here from the rest of Africa who are studying at universities in South Africa, and that certainly is a major contribution, I think, to the capacity of the continent. School building projects, we've had donor support in various areas. These in particular have been the Vodacom Foundation, built schools in Northwest and the Eastern Cape. They're currently working on one in the Popo. Continuing support to provinces around the way that they manage their finances. We have a budget standards exercise. We currently have a number of people working in the Eastern Cape to try and put their systems in order as well. So that's an ongoing process. We have started with the establishment of NEDU, that is the National Education Evaluation and Development Unit. This is broadly an oversight structure which will look at every level of the system and report to the minister in terms of whether it's working or not. This is still in the establishment phase, and it might need legislation during the course of next year to formalize it, but we've started building this structure. Very important development in improving our management information systems. We have now developed what we know as LURIT, a Learner Unit Record and Information Tracking System. This will be a system in which every single learner will be recorded on the system as they enter school, age 5. They will be tracked into the system, and then on a live basis, we will be able to track the progress of those learners. If they transfer from one school to the other, we will know what's happening. If that learner is not progressing in the way they should, we will be able to pick that up straight away. So really, this will be probably the first time we'll have a comprehensive picture of every child in the system, all 12 million of them, where they are, what they're studying, how they're performing, and any issues that we might need to know about them. So really, I think it's absolutely critical part of our system. The issue of school safety, one that has bothered us, and we have now a ministerial project. We have identified some of the schools most at risk and tried to support them in different ways, but I'm very pleased to say that all of the provinces have responded positively on this one, and in two areas. One is trying to look at the physical infrastructure, the fencing and other things that are needed at schools, but also trying to just build with the community this notion of schools as safe and caring centres. People need to know that when they go to school, they are protected, they will be safe, schools do care for them. That's a very critical message that we need to send. The rural education I'm not going to say much about now because we will present on that in a moment. Part of that has been about rationalising it. Regrettably, Madam Chair, many of these schools, rural and farm schools in particular, are really so small as to be both inefficient in financial terms and ineffective in educational terms. They simply do not provide a quality of education that is desirable, and it's very difficult to do that in that very small context. So you will see a number of provinces have now either merged those farm schools, put two or three of them together, four or five of them even together. Some of them have said, no, look, these things just don't work. Let's close these farm schools. And Free State, for example, has established a number of hostels now where they bring these learners from farm schools into these hostel situations. Chair, we know the social concerns there might be around the boarding facilities. But in the end, these children are getting three meals a day, they're getting a decent place to sleep, they're getting supervised homework. I cannot have any doubt that educationally it is beneficial for them, and we continue to promote that. Meantime, though, we do continue our work around multi-grade teaching, which tends to happen in many of these rural and farm schools, and the National Hostel Strategy we'll speak to just now, a rural newsletter, and then finally, just to mention some of the partnerships. One is with the Youth Enterprise Society, and the Dreamfields project, of course, is the one about providing soccer fields in disadvantaged communities. We want to ensure that certainly by 2010, every child has access to a soccer field nearby. So, Madam Chair, that concludes the performance element. If I can just spend a moment on the financials, I don't think there's a lot to say there. Just to reflect on page 13, you have there the breakdown of the allocation versus the actual expenditure, broken down in terms of different categories. Obviously, a large part of our budget does go as transfers to higher education institutions and to other public entities, and other transfers to various organizations and bodies. We also have a substantial amount of our budget that is tied up in conditional grants. So those we have no discretion over. They are really paid out to provinces who meet the conditions. So really, the bottom three lines that largely we deal with as departmental program funding, one is our salary bill, the compensation of employees, the actual operational expenditure, the programs and activities that we get involved in, and then some of the earmark funds that have been made available to us. Chair, I'm pleased to say that of the 19.7 billion that we were allocated, we spent, of the 19.749, we spent 19.709 billion, which reflects a 99.8% spending rate. There is 40 million unspent, and I will explain that in a moment, but as a percentage of our budget, of course, it is relatively low. On page 14, you've just got a different format of the same figures divided up between the seven programs that we have in the department. And again, you will see that in general, they have all had high spending rates. The one exception, we had some limitations in our general education, but I will explain those in a moment. and it again concludes with that 99.8 figure. On page 15, we just explain a little bit about some of the under expenditure. The first one in regards the withholding of the conditional grant transfer to Limpopo. This was on the HIV and AIDS conditional grant. Chair, obviously these amounts are paid out to provinces on a quarterly basis, the conditional grant, but they are only paid out on condition that the province has reported on its previous period and its spending on that previous period. In one instance, Limpopo did not provide that report on time. It is my obligation as accounting officer then to withhold the grant transfer, which we did for a certain time. I'm pleased to say that the province eventually did, in fact, meet the condition, and I was able to finally transfer those funds, but that was after the end of the financial year, so that 6 million that you see as a deviation on the conditional grant is in fact that final amount that was withheld and paid out in the following year. I'm glad to say that we did get some savings because we did not have as many claims from higher education institutions, some of whom had loans of different sorts, and we were able to generate some savings there. That is the 6 million rather that you see reflected as a saving there. Some of the other savings, and in particular the general education one, we had to in fact insist on because we were completely overstretched in regard to the 2008 matric exams. If you recall, Chair, these exams had historically all been administered by the provinces. The full expense of both the setting, the printing and the marking of the exams was borne by provinces. In 2008, for the first time, we moved it into a national mode. So at the national level, we set the papers, we moderated them, we had them duplicated, etc., etc. But all of that was done without any additional funding to the Department of Education. So the provinces effectively had money that they should have been using for exams and didn't have to. We had to run the exams without that, and we therefore had to request other branches of the department to see if they could generate some savings, and I'm glad to say that general education was the one who contributed substantially. Part of that 25 million was a deliberate saving and transferred to further education. Some of the others were just administrative. Some of the stuff that we had done during the last month of the financial year was only rendered after the end of the financial year. We had to then pay it then. And good news, we pay a UNESCO annual membership fee. It is a dollar fee, so when the rand dollar rate exchange rate improves, obviously the amount of rands we have to pay to UNESCO in fact decreased. So we received that benefit, and then also because we pay it in time, we get a discount as well. I'm pleased to say, Chair, that from the Auditor General, we have received an unqualified audit opinion. This is our fifth unqualified audit in a row, so we're very proud of that. And I think I can record here, Madam Chair, that the South African Institute of Government Auditors, in fact, delivered an award to our officers the other day for the best annual report of a national department. I can say that because I'm not responsible, other people write it, but it is nice to be recognized by that kind of body. The Auditor General did raise two matters that they wanted us to attend to. One, they identified inadequate quarterly reporting on performance information. This related to the fact that two of our branches had actually been a little bit late in submitting their second quarterly progress report. So we have had to take corrective steps there, and I'm glad to say that in the third and fourth quarters they were in good time and they've continued with this year. So we don't see that as material, but it is, of course, something we must comply with. And then the Auditor General asked about the usefulness and reliability of the reported performance information. We have agreed with them that some of the measures and indicators are not as well defined as they should be, and some of them indeed not time-bound. I think you would see in our new strategic plan those have indeed been corrected, and I think that we are comfortable with that. So with that, Chair, that concludes, I think, my presentation on the annual report, and I would like to ask Ms. Ndebele now if she could continue with the second presentation on rural education. Thanks.
Thank you, Stephen. Morning, Honourable Member. The second presentation has also been distributed to the Honourable Member. and it's titled Proposed Program of Action for Rural Schools, and I will explain why it's a proposed program of action. I would also like to indicate that I will use the annual report as a starting point in terms of the progress that has been made in this regard, and it's captured in pages 52 and page 53 of the annual report. Maybe just as a brief background, Honorable Chair, to indicate that we've had two major reports that have looked at the state of rural education in this country. The first one was done by the Nelson Mandela Foundation, entitled Emerging Voices, and the second one was actually commissioned by the Minister of Education. There was a ministerial committee that took into consideration the work that the Nelson Mandela Foundation had done and some of their own investigations. And the program that we're speaking about draws on both of those on those reports and the recommendations of those reports. In 2007, when the directorate was established, we embarked on the process of developing a framework for quality education in rural areas. This is because there was an absence, and it's raised in the report, an absence of a coherent framework within which we can deliver quality education in rural areas. And we've taken the document through a number of processes. Our Council of Education Ministers on the 27th of June accepted the broad five areas which I will speak to of the framework, but also recommended, which is why I was saying it's a proposed program. They recommended that because of the magnitude of and the important strategic importance of quality education in rural areas, that process needs to be led by the MECs themselves. CM then set up a cluster of MECs chaired by MEC in the Eastern Cape, and the cluster consists of MEC Eastern Cape, MEC Northwest, and MEC Free State, supported by the department. And the role of the cluster is to develop a program of action for education in rural areas. In terms of the focus of the framework, the framework basically acknowledges that we have quite a number of programs in the department that, if properly targeted, could impact very well in rural schools, whether it's Kids Up, whether it's Funza Lushaga. And the challenge is to prioritize schools in rural areas and ensure that we've got targeted interventions in those schools. But it also acknowledges that the nature of rural areas is that it requires an integrated approach. So it's something that has to be done in partnership with other government departments and other departmental stakeholders. The strategic objectives of the framework, the broad ones, are basically threefold. The first one is to ensure access and retention of learners in rural and farm schools, and I will speak to some of the challenges. The second one is to improve the quality of teaching and learning in rural and farm schools, and lastly, to initiate a sustainable partnership. We've identified five focus areas as part of the strategy. Just to indicate that one of the things that have bedeviled the strategy has been the definition of rurality and rural areas. And I think if I recall very well, when we presented here at the Select Committee, it was one of the areas that the Select Committee in particular requested that it be further investigated. We are working with the Department of Rural Education in clarifying that definition, but we believe that we know sufficiently enough for us to have an implementation program. In relation to the five focal areas, the first one is to improve the quality of teaching and learning in rural areas. And we've identified a number of strategies in this regard. The first one is, at a basic level, to intensify the implementation of the quality learning and teaching campaign. You know, the basic things of ensuring that teachers teach, learners are able to go to class, etc. But also to make sure that we deal with the issues of qualifications of teachers, ensuring that we have qualified teachers that are attracting qualified teachers in rural schools. And to prepare them accordingly. The DG has made reference to the issue of multi-grade teaching. That's, in many instances, is probably not a desirable thing to have, but the situation is such that we need to be able to in the short term enable teachers to be able to handle multi-grade teaching whilst it's being phased out. Another area of concern is the issue of language of learning in our schools, to make sure that home languages are introduced at basic levels, but also to ensure that the curriculum is relevant for those communities without necessarily confining learners into a rural context, but to ensure that there is an integrated curriculum that's implemented there. And lastly, we've got a number of strategies. I'm listing a few to deal with issues of provision of ECD, ensuring that there are ECD centers, and introduction of ICT. We believe that with the advancement of ICT initiatives, there's quite a number of things that we could introduce in rural areas that could promote learning and teaching using ICT. The second one is attracting and retaining learners and educators at rural and farm schools. The issue of distance and the quality of roads is an impediment in learners attending. So we need to make sure that we have a reliable transport system for learners that learners can rely on. But the DG has also made reference to the hostel strategy. We have found, and in fact the Northwest in particular is also leading in this area, where they've amalgamated schools, built hostels, and raised some of the issues of mixing, for instance, learners from lower levels with higher levels. So we're dealing with that, but we believe that hostels are one of the vehicles that we could use to ensure that learners retain. And it's also linked to making sure that we've got incentives for teachers to go and teach in rural areas. There are a number of measures that government has introduced. We need to make sure that there is take up. But central to that is accommodation for teachers, because a number of teachers are unable to take up the post because there are no mechanisms for accommodation. So how do we use local communities to make sure that there is accommodation? Another area of retention which is quite important is the link between general education and further education. There's, in many instances, learners that have completed primary school haven't had opportunities to be able to access further education and training, which has resulted in them either dropping out of the schooling system or having to leave the communities. We obviously are increasing our efforts in ensuring that the guidelines for measures are being implemented. The third focus area is improving infrastructure at rural and farm schools, and it's linked to the retention. Just eradicating at a basic level and at a starting point, eradicating mud and unsafe, dilapidated buildings. Ensuring that together with other government departments, issues of road infrastructure, etc., are being dealt with. But also that if we are expecting teachers to deal with multi-grade teaching, that we make sure that they have resources and facilities to be able to do that. And the Kids Up program has been quite a significant program that has assisted in dealing with the problems. But there needs to be a comprehensive program that will deal with issues of infrastructure in rural schools, because if there's one thing that details and affects quality learning and teaching, it's probably that one. The building of effective school governance and management of rural and farm schools is another area that we would like to focus on. We are not convinced that the current model of governance in other schools is suitable for rural schools. The role of traditional leader, for instance, is sometimes not clear, but that we might want, for instance, to look at the role of higher education institutions in that regard. So we're looking at how what model of school governance can be implemented in rural schools. And last, the last policy area is promoting advocacy and sustainable partnerships. We have a newsletter that we've issued recently that shows what schools can leverage if they have good partnerships. We've had a number of companies that have been able to provide a significant support to rural schools, but also partnerships with other government departments, broader communities, other community development workers, etc., in support of learning in rural areas. What the cluster then did was to look at the framework document, and it is going to be tabled at the CM on the 30th of November for adoption. But also packaged to that was to then say, we need to identify, we need to have a plan that identifies about 450 schools nationally that we can concentrate on for implementation. So the cluster has set up a process of identifying 450 schools nationally. The idea is that we have a plan that is costed, that will be tabled with Treasury to say, if you want us to turn the schools around, this is what it's going to mean in terms of the 450 schools. The plan will implement will focus on the implementation of the strategy in the areas that I've identified, and it will be over a period of 3 years. The criteria for the identification of schools has been communicated with provinces, and they are verifying and submitting the names of the schools. As I've indicated, the approach, certainly from the cluster, is that the eradication of mud schools and INC structures should be the one that is prioritized. As I've indicated, Chairperson, that plan will be tabled at CM on the 30th of November for adoption. And we would gladly, once the cluster has approved it, gladly bring it back to the committee to communicate, probably get further advice on behalf of the cluster. Yeah. Lastly, we are in discussion with the Department of Rural Education around the alignment of the two strategies, because that's of rural development. They have identified priority areas where they are implementing, and we want to make sure that those priority areas are aligned to the priority schools that we've identified. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Now I'm just going to give over to honourable members to interact with the presentation. But before that, DG, I didn't hear you saying anything around the issue of KwaZulu-Natal, where they had a rollover for the conditional grant, which was supposed to be for the early childhood development. If one can get, you know, the update, what is the situation now around that matter? And before I give to the members, maybe to say to the second presenter, I think this is going to take us somewhere, because always we have been having this general perception, you know, when we deal about education, we'll be general, you know. I think this approach that we have a situation where we are going to differentiate, that we've got these rural schools, farm schools, and, you know, I think it's going to assist us to bring all the schools at the same level, because it has been our concern that in most cases, schools from rural areas and farm areas, we felt that they've been neglected. But I feel with this approach, at least we are going to go somewhere. Before I give to the members, Director DG, can you just say something about that matter?
Chair, look, I might have to look into it. I'm a little bit confused. My CFO is confirming we don't have any conditional grant for ECD, so therefore there can't have been any delay from our side in terms of a payment or anything. This must be provincial funds for ECD that for some reason had not been spent and rolled over, but we don't have any funding for ECD for provinces from our side. So if we need, we can investigate the matter and come back to you, but it certainly wouldn't have been from our side, yeah.
Yeah,
can you say that the department will
then do an investigation and give the report to the select committee? We are more interested around that.
We will happily do that, Madam Chair.
Oh, thank you. Time for the members now. Honorable Fiber, Borotho, Blackie, De Villiers, Matamaita, in that order.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Okay, firstly, thanks a lot for the presentation, gentlemen and lady. I'd like first to say that I saw that in some newspaper reports in the last 2-3 weeks that the minister actually said that the outcome-based education was a failure and that they're going back to a system where there's textbooks. I'd like to know when that will be implemented, if and what the costs will be on that, if you look at the current budgets that we were running at, because I know there will be a lot of expenses on new handbooks, etc., especially with new syllabus, etc. Then if you look on page 4, I saw this National Schools Nutrition Program. But, you know, I'd just like to know, shouldn't education stay with the education part? Shouldn't this fall under the social service part, you know, where social services come in? I'd just like to know about that. I'm not exactly sure about that. You know, that educators stay with education and that social services take that part or play that role. Then the big problem that I have, we look at, if we look at the standard of the teachers, I see that we've got all these institutions training teachers, but, you know, you can look at the bottom line, and the standard of our teachers is pathetic. I must be quite honest. I don't know if there's mechanisms or controls to look at the quality of our teachers. The beginning of last year, or actually this year, we went to specific schools on the first day of school, and that there were teachers that did not come on time. Now, I mean, you know, if teachers don't get to school on time on the first day of school, there's no discipline on teachers. So I believe there should be, like, incentives on for excellent teachers to improve performance. We must somehow improve our teachers. If we can improve the quality of our teachers, the children will eventually get up. You know, on a world standard, we are one of the worst countries on pass rates. And we cannot just adopt pass rates and make it 30% and then make it 25% to make our figures look good. I mean, at the end of the day, we are defeating the object. So I believe we should get the standard of our teachers in place. If we can get that, and give incentives to teachers. You know, on the police committee the other day, on security and safety, we had a thing where we said, as soon as a police officer does a good job, he becomes a lieutenant, he becomes a captain, he becomes a major, and, you know, eventually, I believe in teaching, he becomes a principal. But we need good teachers, and to keep the good teachers there, we must give them incentives. Not all the teachers can go up in the rankings, but we should, I believe, give those people incentives, because you get very, very good teachers, and we are losing them through the system because we're not giving them the money that they deserve. And then a big problem that I do have is in grade 8, for instance, we saw a lot of children that go to grade 8 that can hardly read or write, or have any mathematical skills at all. Now, I want to know how a person can get to grade 8 without these mathematical skills or reading skills. That, to me, is a quality problem. There's no quality control mechanisms in place. And then the last thing, I know I've got a lot of questions, Madam Chair, but I believe this is very near to my heart because it's our children that we're talking about. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is ages of learners. That they are in standard 5 or grade 7, children are 17 years old. I believe that that there must be an age restriction where people won't get influenced. Younger children of 13 years old won't be influenced by 17-year-old children in grade 7, for instance. And if that is controlled, and if not, how are we going to control it? Because I also think that is not good for the younger children. Thank you, Madam Chair. The rest of the report I find quite good. I mean, I can't see anything wrong with it, but that's just a few things that I would like answers on, if possible. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson. I really want to commend the department for the report and say that most of the things we need to go, I think I will go the way of the practicality things along the communities from where we come from and what we have seen happening. I really want to commend the department again for coming up with the Northeast schools, which have already covered 60% of our learners. I think that is what we promised our nation. But now the problem comes with this no fee schools, where it happens that within one village or one community, the same community, the other school is a non fee school, the other one is paying school fund. Now you find that the parents do not take their kids to the paying schools. And now we have a problem of teachers in excess and other school next door being overcrowded. I am not sure if the department has looked into ways of trying to minimize the conflict that arises within communities in terms of this. And again, our SGBs being trained enough to understand the reasons behind these schools that are being graded into quintile 1 and quintile 2 and have that understanding. I think the idea is very good, but at the practical part where this is going to be implemented, there are problems. The other one that I have seen that I picked up is the Kids Up initiative, which also is a very good initiative. But from my observation, it seems this Kids Up initiative was not structured and fitted well into the organogram of the district or the regions. Why I am saying so is because the people who are working here are educators that have been seconded from schools. And at that particular, when they are seconded from schools, it means they are disempowering the schools because the staff establishment at the schools remains the same and those teachers cannot be replaced. I am not sure if maybe this is the information that I have that is not longer like that, but what I had seen in some schools is that they take away a teacher and second him to go and work with the Kids Up initiative and the school becomes disempowered. So maybe if the department can see of coming up with a division specifically for this particular initiative, if that has been looked into, it can be left out. The other thing, the DG talked about the teacher development on page 5, okay. When he talked about Funza Lishaka Bazari, honestly, I haven't heard of it. I'm not sure if it was advocated well, but although being a very good initiative, my clarity would be the process of placing, because I heard the DG saying that when you take these graduates, new graduates to schools, they are rejected. I am not sure whether they are brought to the schools just like that, or is there a particular process that is being followed to make sure that these graduates that are needed so much with these skills are put into schools. Because I'm coming from a very rural area, and I know that most of our educators sometimes they are not well qualified, especially with the new curriculum and all. So when you bring a person, those threats are there, you know. Human beings feel threatened. What are the reasons that they may reject these people that have been so skilled? I'm not sure. And when you take them there, does it affect the staff establishment? Because you said, no, people would say, let's keep our own staff. So I don't know what happens. Is it going to affect the staff establishment? Is the old staff going to be removed to somewhere else? Because I know that the old staff, for instance, you have addressed their problem by introducing the NPGE, which you see, has achieved a lot here, 1,063 graduates in 2008. I'm happy to hear that. Because in the rural areas, most of our teachers were not well qualified, but with the NPGE, they've been highly assisted. Chairperson, the ECD, again, a good thought, a good initiative, but I'm afraid of the processes and the qualifications. You know, where I come from, there are many centers of ECDs that are mushrooming. And they mushroom because people are told if you have 50 learners, you will be paid and so on. And now, my problem is these people do not have the proper qualifications to do the job. Now, if they don't have the proper qualifications, is there any measures of screening? Before, as I have already heard the DG saying that they don't have a budget for the ECD centers, but through your communication maybe with the provinces, when these ECD centers are established, is there any screening process, any, you know, provisos for these people to come up with centers? Because honestly, they are mushrooming presently, and there's a lot of forgery that is being done there. The inclusive education white paper 6, I think I have known white paper 6 for more than 5 years or 6 years now. I don't know why it remains a white paper. Maybe the reason why it remains a white, why I'm saying why it remains a white paper is because of the way the implementation is very slow. It's very slow. There is no integration of this learners within into the mainstream. It is not happening. It might be happening on paper, but in schools practically it's not happening. Because even preparations are not there. You know, you go to a school, you find this one child who is on a wheelchair, there is not even a ramp, you know, to take the child to the classroom. So maybe the preparations are not good or what, but the inclusion, the inclusive education into the mainstream, this is a slow process. And we want this process to be fast, hastened, because honestly, the parents that have kids that have impairments, children that are impaired somehow or the other, are having it tough at home because there are no institutions that can take their learners. And that goes with the training of the very learners. I'm left with three. I won't go. How much? Oh, can I pause? Yeah, no problem. I can pause. Thank you.
Chairperson, I've got just few. I'll try to go straight to question and avoid preambles. I'll try to do that, but I'll comment where it's necessary. The first question is on the, I'll take them systematic, is on the teacher development. The Director General spoke about the rating of teachers in terms of the OSD payment. Those who are ordinary teachers, 3%, good teachers, 6%, outstanding, and so on and so on. But what I want to find out, Chairperson, is the what are the actual the baseline criteria for rating teachers? How are what tool do they use to rate them? And the other question is similar to close to that is the evaluation tool. Maybe if you talk about rating and put in an evaluating instrument. And I will also indicate who actually conduct the evaluation. Is it the teacher themselves or the principal, or is it an external or internal evaluation system? That great teacher, that I want to find out from the DDG. And furthermore, because I did not hear the DDG talking about the IQMS. What happened to the HMS? What is it? Is it a provincial thing or is it a national thing? Why is it not captured in the DDD strategic input as he was doing it? That includes LAHIP as well. I've never heard you saying anything about it. I would maybe prefer if the DG will go in and explain on that. The quality improvement, I would not go into details because my colleague has asked that question, but I want to find out from the 700,000 grade R learners which were registered, does this number mentioned here, 700,000, include farm schools or rural areas? If not, what is the problem? If it includes, how many rural schools are actually participating in enrolling learners to the grade R class? And the other question, DG, would be on the inclusive education, the full service schools. Half the time, Chairperson, the full service schools have been problematic in terms of how people in the street talks about it. I want to check with the department if these schools, the full service schools, are they ordinary public schools or are they special schools? Because you'll find out when the school is converted, there is a lot of talking and anticipation about the service schools. Some thought that the full service schools are a special school, and they've got a special preference treatment and a particular curriculum, and teachers will be now expecting department to take them on a full-blown course to train them to be able to manage and run those service schools. I want to just check, are they ordinary schools or special schools? And on the systemic evaluation, DG, this systemic evaluation, well, all of us, when it started, we said it's a good thing that department wants to improve quality. But nowadays, it's like it's an end-of-year test examination. Nobody, including schools, wants to take it extremely serious. So I wanted to check the long-term objectives of this system. Was it to introduce schools to a particular system of writing a particular set of examination paper, or it had a very good intention to achieve at the end of, not in the long term, in the long term? And that goes with the standardized tests that have been set by provinces and all those things. And I must indicate, Chairperson, even if you can take your car now and drive around the school, you will find a very serious frustration on this system. Because you see, the department, these are good things, you must accept. But the practical implementation, rural schools, farm schools, which are supposed to sit and write a standardized test, department will send one question paper for numeracy and expect the poor school to produce, make copies, and that school does not have electricity, does not have water, there is nothing. Instead of writing the examination on a, because even some of these examinations are open-ended kind of examination papers, they will say you start writing on the 2nd of December, it must end on that particular day. There's no like a fixed date that numeracy must be written on the 16th of December, because in that period, some of the people run around with question paper throughout the whole week looking for where they can photostat the paper and write the examination, and there's no coordination, proper coordination in there. But I know that it's not a national competency or a provincial competency to give the matter. But I'm saying, what are the proper oversight of national to provinces to actually assist schools to do that? And my last question is on rural school. Madam Chairperson, the issue rural school is deep rooted, sitting in my heart, and it's burning me. I know the frustration that are there in rural school. I am the product of a rural school. So as and when you are told that there is a framework which was right there for about 3 years, 2007 up to 2009, and nobody said nothing about it. We want to check what was the problem, because in actual fact, learners from rural school have dropped out many a time. Mm. They are not even attending school. Those who are taken by relatives and go and stay with relatives in the township, they also drop out because they are not treated well at those places. So you find out what is the problem with the department not speeding up a process of improving quality in rural schools. And one other point on this rural school, the last point on rural school.
You'll get a second round.
That is the last one, on measures.
You promised that you are going to be straight.
I'm straight to the question.
But you are elaborating.
Oh. On guidelines, Chairperson, the last one on guidelines for merger and closure of rural and farm schools. Straight question. Who's monitoring the strict compliance to these guidelines? Because some of the schools, or whoever is coming from there, he call himself department, close the school, threaten teachers, want them to go and do that. Who is actually monitoring it? Is it the national competency or the provincial competency or the district competency? Because we've got reports that says majority of individual members went to school and want to close them in the name of the department. Some of them are not even department officials. We've got a report that says so. Thank you very much, Chairperson.
Before Honorable Dividius, I was thinking that Honorable, like, you are going to be specific and say that we are having that case in non-Zamo primary school, to be specific, because we went there all over the city.
Thank you, Chairperson. I hope I will stick to only to a question and not elaborate on what I will ask the department. The first one, I'm very, it is for me a very important matter that each and every school must have a library. Now, in the report, I pick up that for the second consecutive year, the building of libraries and also science technology facilities have not been achieved. What is the situation and the measures to accelerate this in the schools and especially in the rural schools? The other question goes is about on the report of page 84 of the document and the report of the department. Some provinces do not give information to the department, so it hampers the work of the department. Which provinces are they? Then on page 83, 10% below the norm of 75% of the spending of the budget in provinces, especially at the end of the third quarter. That report is on 83. Now, provinces submitted third quarter infrastructure reports, and these were presented to HEDCOM on the 17th of March. What is the progress on this situation, so that these provinces who actually are responsible for this is addressed? Then on page 93, the implementation of the plan for education path, that one is terminated or not prioritized now in the department. Now, will the department continue with it? What is the situation around that? And especially around the no-fee schools. In the rural area where I'm coming from, most of the pupils and the learners, they are actually now in a former Model C school. But the learners in that school, they are not in the area where the Model C school learners previously come from. They come from the poor area in our community, the disadvantaged communities. But the school building and the school, where the school is situated now, is a former Model C school. But those those schools are actually now not in the situation where they fall under the quintile 1 or 2, but on under quintile 3. And what is the department currently doing to assess that situation? And is there any plans in the department where the funds can follow the learner? Because most of our pupils in the rural areas, they are staying in our areas, but actually going to the former Model C school. A lot of them are there. And those learners don't get that no-fee fund to assist them. So the funds, they are not for the school, but actually to assist the learner. And that's why I'm asking that question. And my last question, Madam Chairperson, my last one, on page 129 of the document, the department report that the district capacity audit shows that there's some problems. And I'm of the opinion that if we have a good district of education in a certain part of our province, then actually that will go through the system of education very well on the ground to our schools. I thank you.
Thanks, Honorable Chairperson. My questions will first go to the proposed program of action of rural and farm schools. In your report, Madam, you indicated that you are going to develop a national integrated implementation strategy. You also said you are going to develop a criteria for the selection of primary and secondary schools. But you don't give us the light or a sense as to what is the time frame of doing this thing, because you want, after this program is adopted, it must be implemented. So I want to know, when are you going to, what is the time frame of all these things that you say you are going to develop? And another question is, in relation to the targeting of 150 schools, for all 9 provinces in a 3-year period. I just want to check the breakdown in terms per province. Can we get the, what is the breakdown per provinces? And in the presentation on page 7, there is this investigation which has been conducted to determine the implementation of inclusive education. And the manner in which it is reported here, it seems as if it is still on, that investigation. Why can't it be reported on the findings of the investigation? Because we are dealing with an annual report here. We are not dealing with a strategic plan, which it seems are going to still, we are going to do this investigation. Can you get the findings of this investigation? And then in the annual report, the Auditor General reported here that he was unable to obtain evidence that the department prepared and submitted its second quarterly report for 2008 and 2009. I just want to get a sense, what is happening here? Why the department could not, avail the evidence for Auditor General to be able to do his audit? Lastly, Honorable Chair, DG, you also reported in the document that you are going to occupy a new building, which you start in March next year, which you have contracted for 25 years. And you further said in the report that after 25 years, the building, the furniture, all equipment will be, you know, given to the department. I don't know whether I'm doing, but I just want to get a sense here. Is there any value for money for this, you know, 25-year contract? And how much will be paying per month? The department will be paying per month? Can we just get a sense there? Thank you, Honorable Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Member. There will be a second round. I'm just going to give over to the department to respond to questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and a substantial set of questions. Clearly the members have done their homework and read the annual report. But thanks for those, Chair, and certainly we appreciate them. Perhaps to try and go through them in order, Chair. The question around OBE, I think, Chair, here, firstly, we need to stick to the focus of the discussion, which, of course, is around the annual report. But not to deny the issue, the Minister did do a media briefing yesterday where I think she clarified in a very good way the understanding around OBE and whether it had been a failure or not, etc. So I don't want to go into that debate, Chair, but just to say in terms of the question, it's not a matter of back to textbooks. Textbooks have always been there. In fact, we've spent in excess of 3 billion rand a year on textbooks, so there's no issue about going back to something else. And also, let me clear up, there's no new syllabus being prepared. All we're talking about is turning the current curriculum framework into a far more explicit set of documents so that teachers will understand what this means, etc., and make sure that they've got the right materials. The additional funding that is asked about, I think the main amount, and this again is for current year, is the 524 million rand added in the appropriations budget for workbooks for foundation phases, and those will be spent before the end of this financial year. So it is important, but I think the message we've tried to get through is trying to counter what you write. Some teachers did understand that we were saying textbooks didn't matter anymore. I think the emphasis has come back to say textbooks do indeed matter. In fact, all the international evidence tells you they're one of the most cost-effective ways of getting quality improvements is to make sure that there's a decent book in everyone's hands. So certainly for the foundation phase, we will ensure that every child has two workbooks from the beginning of the year, one for literacy and one for numeracy. But as I say, there are provincial budgets that are being used. Your question about the school nutrition program, is it right for us to do it? Look, there are probably always questions like that. Of course, the school nutrition program moved, it was with the Department of Health, recall, and in 2005-06 it was moved across to the Department of Education. Chair, look, to the extent that it's delivered in schools, obviously makes it logical that education should run with it, but I think you are picking an important point, is that schools can't be everything to everybody. They can't provide social services, feeding, health services, everything else, but I think we can say that at the moment it probably is the most effective placement, but it does need a lot of support to the school, and that's where these community groups coming together I think have helped, so that you're not indeed and rightly taking teachers away from their duties in order to get involved in school nutrition, and we'll certainly monitor that. All right. Look, on the teacher training one, it is still a critical issue, but I think we must distinguish between, in a sense, the training that builds certain competencies, and clearly that is something we've got to work at. We must recall that most of our teachers, in fact, were relatively badly trained pre-1994. Much of that training did happen at the teacher training colleges, and I think to a large extent we still suffer the legacy of that kind of training, which was undoubtedly inadequate, and I would hope that our new graduates coming out are of a different caliber, having been trained properly at the university. And I would just note that the Council on Higher Education monitors the quality of those programs very closely. In fact, there was a story in the media over the weekend about a number of teacher training programs that have had to be discontinued because the CHE has refused to accredit them. They tended to be more postgrad than initial training, but CHE does watch that very closely indeed. So that's the one aspect, and it's around the competencies, the qualifications of teachers, and we continue to work on that in different ways. But I think it must be distinguished from, in a sense, the
the discipline and will to exercise those competencies properly. So it's all very well, you can have the best trained teacher in the world, if they don't arrive on time prepared, that training is meaningless. And by contrast, let's be honest, there are many under-trained, under-qualified teachers who do a sterling job, simply because they arrive early, they work late, they support over weekends, etc. So we mustn't confuse those two issues of training and qualifications with the discipline side. Of course, on the discipline side, we have, you know, with the leadership of the president, spoken about these non-negotiables. Being in class, on time, ready to teach, and of course the teachers rightly have said that's not just about us, it's about the learners. Are they also in class? Have they done their homework? Are they respecting teachers? Are parents playing their role in terms of making sure their children get to school, do their homework, etc., being involved in their parents' meetings, etc.? And then rightly, of course, the unions have said, what about your officials as well? Are district people subject advisors? So it's about everybody in the system doing their job, not beyond the call of duty, but just as duty requires it. If everyone just did their bit as they were supposed to, quite honestly, we would see the system working, and I think that is what we're trying to build around, and that, in the end, as the President has said, is not a Department of Education issue, it's not a government issue, it's a societal issue. We need society to monitor what's happening in schools, and that really is what the Quality Learning and Teaching campaign is about. I can announce here, by the way, that with the sponsorship of MTN, they've now set up an SMS hotline where, under the Quality in Learning and Teaching campaign, you can send in messages. Now, they're hoping that the messages are going to be about good teachers. So if you know of a good teacher doing good work in some school, please SMS that to this hotline number, 32727. Let them know that she has a good teacher, because part of what we're going to do is hold up these good teachers as models and get others to emulate them. Clearly, if someone wanted to use that hotline to also report a bad teacher, I suppose that has to be legal as well. So if you do pick up someone who's not doing their job, let's hear about them, because that ultimately is where we, you know, whatever inspectorate we build, we can never be in 27,000 schools on every day. The people who are there are the people around it. And Madam Chair, a lot of this is about expectations. I was at a school the other day about 11 o'clock on a Friday, and all the teachers had gone. But there were some parents milling around, and I said to them, you must be very cross with your teachers. And they said, no, why? And I teased them. I said, but haven't you noticed? They've all gone. And then they teased me, and they said, no, but haven't you noticed? It's Friday today. And I said, what do you mean? And they said, but isn't this what happens, Friday, teachers go... I said, no, in fact, in good schools, they're there till late Friday, Saturday they come to extra meals, and on Sunday they're ready prepared. All they said, we'd better take this up with our teachers, so it's part of telling people what they should have a right to expect. Mm-hmm. And that's about 7 hours a day, in class, on time, so please help us to publicise this thing. That's what we need, and we're not calling for vigilantism. We don't want parents to go in there and haul the teacher up. Maybe some of us do, but let's not say we're public, we want that. Chair, if there's a problem in the school, take it up with the district manager. Let's hear about what is and isn't happening.
Let me just say something around that matter. We once had a situation in Saizranik where the parents were up and up against the teachers, because most of the teachers were from Johannesburg. Mm-hmm. And what was happening is that every Friday these teachers will leave early. And I think it goes back to the issue that you raised earlier on, that the resistance that graduates get when they are deployed into other areas, that, you know, people feel that if you're not from this area, you won't be committed.
No, sure.
You know, you'll just tell yourself that I'm just there to work Friday, I just go home.
No, it is a concern. There's some good signs developing. We had a case the other day when the Eastern Cape, some teachers were packing up early because they had a union meeting and it was 2 hours away. They had to leave early, and the learners actually went out and they locked those school gates. And they said, at 3 o'clock, you're free to go wherever you like. Until then, in class, on time. We also got given the other day, the Young Communist League, in fact, have developed a sort of template for learners. And they've got learners in schools now. Every lesson, they write down, teacher so-and-so arrived at this time, they taught for so long, and then they left or whatever. And at the end of the day, they give those reports. And so that's the mode that we've got to get into, Madam Chair. And as I say, it's moving. Of course, we had that horrible thing the other day where some teachers in Soweto were threatening to walk out. And together with the MEC, she mobilized the parents. And the parents called a meeting and said to the teachers, now come and tell us about your plan. And of course, not one teacher was ready to come to that meeting. So that's where the power lies, and we've got to insist on that, Madam Chair. And it's a very important dynamic. Just to finish it up, though, we are, as I say, providing incentives around the performance issue. There's some issues to still work out around the instruments you raised, etc., around that. But also let me respond to the issue of the progression. We do have a career path now for a classroom teacher. You can remain a classroom teacher for 30 years and actually be earning more than your school principal because you're a good teacher and that's what you want to be. Yeah? So please have a look at that and encourage teachers to think about this career path rather than just the management one itself as well. All right. On the no fee schools and the quintiles, look, it's an ongoing problem, and the point you make about schools next to each other, etc. We must understand on this issue of quintiles, in the end, if we're going to have affirmative action for poor schools, we've got to have some mechanism that ranks schools in different ways. Now, you can fight about what those mechanisms are. We use Stats South Africa data about the poverty of the area, etc., because generally, poor schools are in poor communities. That's your overall pattern. But of course, there are exceptions to that. But you must understand that for any school to move down a quintile, in other words, to be declared a poorer school, and I must say it's a little bit funny, Chair, because actually you're getting schools now competing to be poorer than the next one, because you have to get more money from the state as a result. But for any school to move down, another school has to move up. So everyone tells us about this school that should come down a quintile, and you say to them, that's fine, more than happy with that, but tell us now which school should move up a quintile, and then, of course, you're not as happy to do that. So we do the quintiling, but please understand, at a provincial level, any school is entitled to appeal its ranking to the MEC, and the MEC would have to look into the exact circumstances and obviously in consultation with the community decide whether in fact it should be in this quintile or not, and that is there. But I like your comment about children now going to the no-fee school rather than the fee-paying school. That's precisely what we want to happen. Not that we overload the no-fee school, but certainly we want to see children going to no-fee schools. That's the purpose of them. In fact, our biggest worry when we set up no-fee schools was that these would become kind of ghetto schools that people didn't want to go to. In fact, the evidence is different. People are leaving fee-paying schools, going to no-fee schools, and still getting quality education. So that is a good thing, and I think we want to encourage it.
They go to the no-fee schools, they leave those schools, teachers, what is
going to
call this, that you have to
be deployed.
Redeployment problem now.
Yeah. No, look, I mean, those are consequences of it, but let's be honest, people, we have, our ruling, and it's different to many countries, we do not have any fixed, firm zoning in this country. Many countries, you have to attend your local school, you have no choice. We said, no, parents must have that choice. Parents will go and seek quality, there's no doubt, and it's a good thing. So if that school, maybe if it's to do with fees, is the wrong reason for people to leave it, but certainly if that school is not providing quality, we want to see people moving out of that school so that in the end, if need be, that school must be closed down or the teachers moved out or whatever. So those are consequences that we need to deal with, but in the end, as I say, the principle of people finding the school at the best cost and the best quality is probably a good thing. I will pick up with your issue around the kids up, people being seconded. Certainly our understanding, any time a teacher is seconded out of school, there must be a relief teacher then put in. If that's not happening, we need to find that out. All right, so the Funzulu Shaka issue, and I'm sorry you haven't heard about it, because certainly we've tried to publicise it as best we can, but let us know if there are other steps we can do, because this is something that, again, publicly we need to encourage people to become teachers. And you know, this notion that youth don't want to become teachers is absolute rubbish. We are completely oversubscribed for Funzulu Shaka bursaries. We have about 3 times as many applicants as we can give bursaries to, which is wonderful because we then select the best. And part of that selection, by the way, is we select teachers, A, who come from rural areas, because we know that the chances are good they will go back there, but also we want people who are committed to teaching in South Africa. We don't want to invest in a teacher who, once they're qualified, is going to pack up and push off. So those kind of things are happening, and people are here. The The placement issue, maybe we've been insensitive, and I need to check on what's happened there. The fact is, in terms of the law, if we have trained a teacher, we are not obliged to go through the SGB process. So we don't have to wait for an SGB recommendation if we've invested in a teacher. But that doesn't mean, I think, as you're implying, that we can just kind of parachute in these teachers and assume that it's going to be well accepted. So perhaps we need to look with provinces at how that is being approached. But in the end, yes, if the qualified teacher is brought in, the unqualified teacher clearly must lose their job. That's why unqualified teachers are only ever appointed on a temporary basis. It means that at the end of that year or whatever, they must move out and make place. And in the end, we want qualified teachers in our schools. That must be, I think, a strong commitment. The ECD centres, let's just clarify, ECD centres we refer to obviously now as the preschool centres which are catering to the 0 to 4 year old age group. Those are both regulated, they're registered, and the subsidies are paid by the Department of Social Development, all right? So they know who these centres are, and they know how many children they've got so they can get the subsidies. Look, part of the requirement for registration is that the teacher be qualified. But the truth is, what that was doing is in fact then penalizing those centers that were trying to get something going in your poorest community. They found some person who was willing to become the facilitator for that ECD center, but then social development was saying, no, but you can't get a subsidy because this person's not qualified. So we finally persuaded them, turn that thing around. Register the site, give them the subsidy, and let's make sure that that teacher gets upgraded and gets a qualification. So that's what the education department does. We work with the educators. We've got about 3,000 or 4,000 now, I know, registered with the ETDP CETA for a level 4 qualification in ECD. So we're saying, get the subsidy flowing, get those children looked after, and as soon as possible, we will make sure that teacher is trained. But I would hate for a centre not to be opened simply because you're saying we haven't got a qualified teacher there. In the end, the children are the primary interest. We must try and push that. But again, let me say there's no conditional grant there. But if these institutions are mushrooming, it's a good thing because children benefit from this, and we'd like to see it happening. Finally, from the questioner, on the White Paper 6, I did say it was going to be a slow process. As I say, the White Paper itself refers to 2020 as the target by which many of these things would happen. So we knew it was a big and complicated policy, and we acknowledged that up front. The reason it's still a White Paper is because that policy hasn't changed. So a White Paper stays, same as our White Paper 1, it's still in place. Until, and if we change our policy, then we'll produce another white paper. But that is still our policy position. Mainstreaming is slow. Madam Chair, I would suggest it should be, because the last thing you want to do is push people into a mainstream school where there is no particular support or real ability of that school to provide for that child. So unless we are confident that that school is able to receive a learner with special needs, I would be cautious about them being pushed into that kind of situation. So let me recognize that. Sorry, I missed some of the questions from the earlier one that I should note. I've got them here. The comments about grade 8s that can hardly read or write. I just want to say beware of generalization. Someone made that about matric students the other day, and they have not yet been able to produce the evidence of these learners who can't read and write, but so be it. What I can say is that we now conduct national assessments on every grade from 1 to 6 every year. So every child at the end of every year from grade 1 to 6 is writing a national standard assessment. It's written in the school, it's marked by the school, so we don't pick up the results or anything, but it should give a very clear idea of what should be expected, what the child should be able to do, and what we've said is those results must go to the parents, must go to the governing body so they can monitor it there as well, all right? And then on the age issue around the overage learners, we do have age norms in place, and the age norms say that no child should spend more than one additional year per phase. So over your four phases, you should never spend more than 1 year additional in any of them. So yes, it could mean that learners are slightly older, but you certainly shouldn't get those 17-year-olds, as you say, sitting in grade 6 or whatever. In that instance, we've got to look at diversion. One of them, obviously, is the FET colleges. Once you've done grade 9, if you really are 17, 18 by that stage, really the encouragement must be go and look at a technical college there, an FET college. Those would be the right ones. We are at the moment, of course, rebuilding our technical high school, which might also be the kind of place where many of these learners should go. If they're not academically strong, perhaps they would do better there. So diversion, I think, is part of that. The Honourable Plonicky asked a number of questions about teachers and teacher development. IQMS, sorry, I didn't mention it. It is still the instrument that we have agreed on with the unions. That, in terms of the OSD agreement, was indeed the instrument that we have preferred. That is initially done by the teacher and the supervisor in the school, but in the past 2 years, we've employed now nearly 100 what we've called IQMS moderators. So these are external people who then go to the school. And what we've picked up, you know, you get a school that's only got a 30% pass rate, and yet in IQMS, you know, everyone got 100%. The first thing we do there is we say, moderator, won't you just go in and have a look at those scores, all right? And it's starting to throw a very different dynamic. So we're starting, I think, to get that system right. There's been a bit of a debate now through the Teacher Development Summit on the relevance of IQMS. There is an argument that is saying IQMS is for development, and we need another instrument for evaluation and pay issues. So that's under discussion with the unions itself, and we'd have to see what comes out of that process. The language and education policy, I didn't mention it really because there is no change on that. We are still tied to that policy. We're trying to look at its implementation. But you might want to note just there's a little comment made yesterday by the minister in her media briefing around the exposure of learners to English, where they are going to be using English as the medium of instruction later, that even in the early years where we are encouraging home language, mother tongue instruction, we are saying even there it is beneficial for children just to hear English being spoken. Whether they understand it or not doesn't matter, but it's important just to hear it through TV, people reading, whatever it is. So perhaps it's a little refinement, but it's not changing the policy at all. The grade R learners, certainly it would include your farm school and rural learners. As I say, we reckon the overall cohort is about 800,000, some 700,000 are there at the moment. Certainly they would include farm and rural schools. Most of these grade R classes are not schools themselves. It's a class just attached to a school, and that's the preferred option. But as I say, we do still have some standalone ECD and grade R centres, particularly in the urban areas, and they would accommodate a number of others. The issue of the full-service schools, please, we must understand, full-service schools are ordinary schools which have been adapted to try and accommodate for learners with special needs who can benefit from a mainstream education. But I think, you know, and I think when we first published White Paper 6, we had the perhaps mistaken idea that almost every child could be fitted into that category and could go to an ordinary school. So most of our emphasis was on mainstreaming, on converting schools. What we have recognized, of course, is that there are some learners who definitely can't be mainstreamed. They do need a special school with special facilities and special teachers. So the full-service schools are your public ordinary schools that have been converted, but we are also now investing very heavily in our special schools as well, because you need both of those there. But to recognize that at this stage there are only 12 full-service schools across the country. It's not enough, and as I say, we need to pick up the pace on that, there's no doubt. The systemic evaluation, we're continuing with that process, and it certainly helps us to get information about how the system is performing. But as I say, these have been supplemented now by national assessments, which are not a sample anymore. It's every single one of our grade 1 to 6 learners that are being tested. But systemic evaluation is an important instrument. We continue with it, partly because we've done it over a number of years, so we've been able to see the trends with it, and that's important. And then the rural schools, perhaps Ms. Ndebele will deal with, but just to say on the mergers and closures, the South African Schools Act provides the legal basis in terms of how a school can be closed or merged. There's no deviation from that and has to be compliant. But the guidelines are, as indicated, there are indeed guidelines. So it might be that a province says, hold on, we're not doing this step now, we're going to do it in a different order or something. That's fine, but in the end, only the head of department has the authority to close, open, or merge a school. So any thing by the district, unless there has been a formal written delegation to that district, which I doubt, would only be saying this is a recommendation. In the end, it is the head of that provincial department who would have to decide on whether a school is indeed open, closed, or merged. Chair, on the issue of school libraries, I'm glad to say that our new norms and standards, of course, provide that new schools must be provided with libraries. There's no ambiguity about that, and we are in the final stages now of finalising a library policy, which would allow not just for the normal library that we might know, but also for class libraries, grade libraries, those kind of things. So we'll come to you, I think, perhaps when we've got there. In the end, of course, we haven't achieved as much as we would have liked in this regard. These libraries have to be provided by provinces out of their budget, and as I said earlier, too often where they look to taking these big new steps, suddenly they are told about a school that lost its roof in a tornado or a school that got damaged in a storm, so the library they had planned for next month now has to fall away, we have to take a step back and go and fix that school, etc., etc. So it is an ongoing process that we'd have to look at that, all right? On the issue of some of the reporting issues, there were comments around the report saying that some provinces had provided information late. This largely pertains to issues of infrastructure and getting data out of them. I'm happy to say that certainly during this year provinces have got much better, partly because they were almost named and shamed in the previous round, where when we reported to our Council of Education Ministers, our MINMEC, that the foreign provinces hadn't reported, of course the MECs there got very upset with their provinces, so now they do insist that that is in fact happening, and they are moving on it. The conditional grant spending I mentioned earlier, we monitor that very closely, and unless a province is using its money, we certainly won't pay over the next tranche. We have withheld in some instances where that is the case. The question of the education pulse, I think we could probably say it has been discontinued. I don't think we're aiming to revive that. It might be that under the NEDU, the National Education Evaluation Development Unit, something like that might be resuscitated. But at this stage, I don't think we would be looking at that. And then finally, again, just on the quintile determination, I think I've been through that, but let me confirm that funds do in fact follow the learner, in the sense that schools get a per capita subsidy based on the number of learners they have. So where a learner transfers to a school, that allocation travels with them, but of course it travels depending on the quintile of that school. But what we have recently put out for public comment is a system of compensation now. So where a school, a fee-paying school, does in fact exempt a learner from fee payment, we are offering now compensation to that school, where that school will receive an allocation for that learner that they have exempted from fees. So they will not have to bear the full cost of that exemption. We would in fact give them compensation for that. So I'd invite you to look at that and possibly comment if you think we're on the right track there. The issue of the capacity audit at the district level, I think, has been completed, and really the district policy that I spoke about that has been drafted has in fact now responded to that audit and tried to indicate what would be needed at the district level. Finally, Madam Chair, from the Honourable Mashamiti, on the rural ed, I think Ms. Ndebele might want to comment there as well. The inclusive education has been, the investigation has been concluded, and as I indicated, one of the main things that came out of there was the absence of these assistive devices, so we've responded to it in that regard, but certainly, Chair, if you wished, we could bring you a full presentation on that investigation and indicate what it was that we found. On the Auditor General report and the issue about the two reports, I can confirm that later on we did provide that evidence to the Auditor General. They have acknowledged it, and as I say, it was simply a case of two of the seven branches reporting a little bit late on their second quarter report, so until we had received it, we couldn't provide it to the Minister. I can indicate that although it was a little bit late, eventually these were provided to the Minister, and that issue has been corrected. On the issue of the new building, I want to say a couple of things. Firstly, of course, it is done through a public-private partnership. We were encouraged to look at that as a building approach, and I think in broad terms it has been successful, but let me say that the amount of administration is unbelievable. When you're renting a building for 25 years, which includes issues of cleaning, etc., you have to try and calculate how much it's going to cost to clean that building in 25 years' time. And what is the cost of a cleaner at that stage? I mean, really, you're doing a huge amount of financial forecasting and projections, etc. So it's a complicated process, certainly. But in the end, I think if you get a chance to come and see the new building, you will agree that it is a magnificent new facility. Of course, it has been complicated a little bit by the split in the department, because the original assumption, of course, was that the old Department of Education as a whole would move in there. Now, of course, with the department having split, it has at least complicated that situation. If it was just a matter of splitting, it might have been said that we could both have still gone into the new building, but not only have we split, of course, we've included a large contingent from the Department of Labour, the whole skills development section, that has actually said the department is, the new building is too small for both departments to move into, although arguably some have said it might be too big for just half of the one department to move into. So we're having to work that together with Treasury and see what the implications are, but that is one of the issues we have to pick up as a result of the decision to split the ministries. I should also point out that the building we're in at the moment is a rented building, so we are paying a monthly rent at the moment of about 10 million rand, and in fact the cost assessment that we've done with National Treasury has indicated that over the 25-year period certainly there will be cost savings, because as I say, apart from the rent that we're currently paying, we now pay our own security, we pay our own maintenance, we pay our own cleaning, we pay our own furniture. Everything in the new building is now covered under the new rental, and that will be the provision that we will have for the new building. So I think it is certainly going to be value for money, but as I say, it's been a bit complicated by the split of the department, and that is something that we're still working on. Let me pause there, Jen, and invite Ms. Ndebele Bamster to comment on the rural education one. Or anyone else.
Thank you, DJ. Maybe to start from the end with the Honorable Mashamaita's question. The around the implementation process, the time frames, as I indicated, Chair, we have an implementation plan. The only reason I didn't circulate it is because it's serving at CM on the 30th, and we are committed to bring it back to the select committee. However, in terms of the time frame, certainly between now until the end of March, we want to have finalized the strategy, and when I say strategy, I mean the plan that incorporates all the 450 schools, and that includes having done a baseline study of where those schools are, what the conditions of those schools are at the moment, what the provincial situation is in relation to either the measures, etc. That also includes having done consultations with relevant stakeholders. So the plan is that certainly by the 31st of March we have a plan that is costed based on the 450 schools that we could present for funding and implementation to start in the new financial year. The second question is around the criteria. We have the criteria that we've distributed to the provinces, and it's wide-ranging. It includes schools that form part of the presidential and RDP nodal areas, because those are the priority areas of government. We're saying at least those schools must benefit from Kids Up, No Fee schools, so that it's just coordinating of existing interventions. We're also saying that where we select secondary schools, it must be together with the feeder primary schools, so that there is continuity around a balance between poor performing schools and effective schools, and schools that are in a state of abject physical degradation should also be included. In terms of the breakdown, it's a proportion of the number of schools that rural and farm schools that provinces have. So I'll give you the breakdown. Eastern Cape is 65, Free State is 50. We agreed that Gauteng and Northern Cape, because they have few schools, they would have 30 each. KwaZulu-Natal is 70, Limpopo 65, Mpumalanga 55, Northwest 55, and Western Cape 40. That makes a total of 450 schools. The MECs are looking at the list that the provincial officials suggested and would then ratify those lists. In relation to Honorable Blake's question around the guidelines, in fact, that's the reason why we had the guidelines, because there's been such problems with measures, even though it's very clear who decides on the closure of schools. But the contestation sometimes within communities themselves has made it very difficult for the guidelines to be implemented. Incidentally, that's one of the reasons why this program, in fact, is now driven at a political level, because the impatience around implementation is probably one of the issues that CM was communicating. And the absence of the framework doesn't mean that there hasn't been work that has been done. What we wanted was to make sure that for the first time we have an integrated approach to delivery of education in rural areas, and that we're able to put as part of the process a monitoring strategy, and we're able to say we've started with 450 schools, they were here when we started, these are the things that we've provided, and we move to the next set of schools. But it must be measurable, and we must be able to be able to defend the choices that we have made. I think I've answered the first question.
Thank you. DJ, I just want to comment on the issue, but I'm happy that you indicated that the issue of the National Nutrition Program, which is a good initiative. But my concern is around the quality of the food that the children are getting. Really, it's really disturbing. You go to school, you find a situation where children are being fed, you know, stamped, you know, which is just cooked without anything from Monday to Friday. You go to some schools where that issue with just biscuits, fried ones, you know, every day, you know. You ask yourself, really, what is it that you want to achieve at the end of the day? There are schools who are having this vegetable garden, but you go there, it's only cabbage. Because the last time when I visited one school in the farm, I was even with officials from agricultural department, where I was taking with them, can they give, because they're issuing their seeds, you know, can they give something different besides cabbage? You know, I think these are the issues that really we have to be concerned about. I just want to comment on the issue of maybe the one that was raised by Honorable Fiber, the issue of the age. You know, the reality on the ground is that when we go to the previously disadvantaged schools, our educators are unable to detect at an early age when a child is having a problem. That is why we find that we've got these special schools, not special schools for physically challenged children, but for those kids who are slow learners. Mm-hmm. And we don't seem to be making use of these schools. You know, we've got one in Clarkstop, but when you go there, most of the children there are white. It simply says to you, children, our previously disadvantaged schools, they are not even aware of these facilities. You know, we've got two in the Northwest, one in Bruce, one in Clarkstop. I'm saying maybe that is also a matter of concern, you know, that our teachers can't detect the problem of children at an early age. And this is another report that we got from, because some of the issues are really cross-cutting, from Science and Technology last week when they presented here, which really is a worry to me, that according to their research, most of the graduates from the former black universities, they are not employed when they compare it to the graduates from like the University of Cape Town. You know, I think we requested them to do more research and give us a report, you know, go deeper into this thing so that when we deal with the research, because it's a concern. What is that? Are you saying the graduates from former black universities are not well qualified or what? You know, I think it's a matter of concern. But my question also, the last question will be, we've got the ministerial project around violence. Yes, there were schools that were identified. can we just get a progress report, or if this project has been extended to other schools, what is the state, you know, and what is happening around that? I'm going just to give to other members maybe to let me start with the new one.
The
old ones, I'm just going to give just an opportunity for one question.
Okay.
Blackie, and yourself, the whole room, except Honorable Fiber.
Thanks, Chairperson. Chairperson, I just want to make a comment or an advice to the DG on the rural schools program. Can we have also on rural areas the data of learners that have passed grade 12? Because we've got that in my area at Okahlamba. We've got the data in the district office, but I think they don't know where. I'm not sure they don't know where to process it or what is going on, because there are grade 12 learners that are just sitting and doing nothing. Some of them are selling their bodies to get money. Again, what is the department doing, DG, about the teachers that are going to other fields? Like a teacher, he's a teacher and he's also a counselor. What is the department doing, negotiating or whatever, to with the unions and the organizations about those teachers? Because I think they are also failing the system in a way, because they've got all this double work to do. In the Kids Up program, this Kids Up program has been investigating it in the Eastern Cape. Many of the rural areas where I'm coming from, they don't know this, especially the principals and the EDOs. They don't know about this Kids Up initiative. I don't know how was it the information of these Kids Up, how is it disseminated to them. Also, I would love to know about the international exam that was written last year by the primary schools. Is it still going on? Is it still evaluated nationally? Or is it now taken down to the locals? Because in the national, they are taking the average of the area, and then they don't deal with the specific school, the problem in the specific school. Thank you, Dish. Thank you, Chairperson.
Okay.
Okay.
Thanks, Chairperson. I'm interested to know about the building of a new university in Mpumalanga. At some stage, I heard the premier of, is it Mpumalanga?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. On media, saying that they intend to build a university in Mpumalanga. That means that there's work that has been done in the past financial years around that. Can you tell us about this new university in Mpumalanga and Northern Cape? And the second question is on page 167 on program 5. It reads some 12,000 learners reached via the peer education care and support pilot program. And according to the comments here, the program will be refocusing the HIV and AIDS strategy through peer education workshop. The donor fund was utilized for drug and substance abuse prevention. According to the progress of the report, of this particular program, it looks like the focus is more on peer education more than the care and support that is referred to. I would like to suggest that to the department that when you do the refocusing of this particular objective, you need to focus more on care and support, because I can believe that from the learners that are benefiting out of this program, it will assist them a lot. And secondly, what I want to know is what happens to the teachers who are identified as positive and those who are sick and are at work. What does the department do about these particular teachers? The kind of support that you are giving to these teachers is very important. And on page 161, the objective is to increase the participation of girl learners in gateway subjects in public schools. And the comment says, you have reprioritized due to lack of available funds and a lack of response from donors to the project proposal. Was this objective not budgeted for by the department? And how do you intend to address this particular challenge? Which one is this one? ICT on page 144. The feasibility study is completed by an ICT implementation initiated in a coordinated system. And the feasibility study did not recommend a public-private partnership. Therefore, there was no need for the feasibility study report to be submitted for Treasury Approval 1 and 2A. Can you please elaborate on this particular objective? What is it exactly saying? The last one. The last one is on 116. The strategic objective here is to ensure effective implementation of an inclusive curriculum. Then it goes further and on the comment number 4. The focus is, comment number 5. A model for retraining and district support was put in place via the Arts and Culture Program. This will assist teachers. The training program did not reach the targeted number of persons. Why did it not reach the targeted persons? That's all for me.
Yeah, thanks, Honorable Chair. On page 241 of the report, DG, it was reported that the department instructed all senior managers to declare their financial interest to the minister on an annual basis. And furthermore, all employees in the department are also compelled to request permission from the DG before they do any business with the department, the work outside the department. Now, I want to check as to whether in your department, DG, are all these employees or senior managers declared their financial interest. And if so, can we be provided with the record, the list of all senior managers and their declarations? Thank you, Honorable Chair.
I am just going to ask one question, Chairperson, I promise. What I wanted to check is on rural schools, on the framework. Whether did the department solicit buy-in of all stakeholders in terms of input in the framework, and whether did they consider pending the PPM of farm schools, maybe make PPM, because PPM is broad, make it be biased to the farm school. Shouldn't be like an open blanket PPM to every school. I would say why I'm saying it, Chairperson, is once again, that if a farm school would have all the grades, grade 1 up to grade 9, for example, because of the PPM would only have qualified for 2 teachers in terms of the post basket. So can't you, and the one teacher would teach grade 1 to all the foundation phase, the other one would teach grade 4 to grade 9. Can't we be biased and have a PPM that will assist, no relief a farm school in terms of that? And the mega school, the Director General you talked about, is one I know in the Northwest Province. I'm not saying I like the school, but I'm not happy that, if you create a school, you take a dilapidated, like the one I'm talking about is in the military base. They take a military base, you take kids, teach them there. I would love to see a situation like the Director General said about the example of Limpopo. Create a school with a sense of being a school, and so learners must attend. Do not convert a particular building, take children to it. And so.
So, one request, one question, and one concern. Concern is about the students receiving their funds late. Students, that's the concern. The question is around school safety program on page 178. The monitoring of implementation of the code of conduct for learners did not take place. There was a delay. Can the department just elaborate on that? And then the request is a report on mathematics and science survey. Can the department maybe give that report also to the committee?
And one comment. Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, I will go to whole school evaluation, combine it with district development. From the report, they are saying that they have appointed new supervisors for whole school evaluation. Now, coming from Mpumalanga, I have realized that there is a duplication of jobs in terms of job description. That's why I said I'm going to combine it with district development. In that, you find the whole school evaluation division coming to a school with a particular instrument or a tool to do their work. Then we have also the curriculum support also coming with their instrument. Teacher development, which goes with IQMS, because when we talk of the SIP and the SMTs to evaluate schoolwork, we are talking IQMS line. Now, and teacher development. And then we have this other one component called ISOME in Mpumalanga, which duplicates the work of all this other that I have already mentioned. Now, has the department maybe looked into that, or was it not aware? Because honestly, to teachers, it becomes a burden. Today I come in as a curriculum, with my curriculum support to a teacher and tells him what to do, and the other component comes in and said, no, this is not how it's done. Let me shorten it there. And then say, lastly, we are happy on health that you have brought, we are talking life skills. And there is also life orientation, which is compulsory to every learner, which we welcome because it's assisting in terms of life skills and physical education. But coming to the physical education part itself, the previously disadvantaged schools have got a problem of infrastructure. In that, learners have got to go out of class for this particular period. Maybe they are doing, because if I remember well, every two periods, one period is for physical education. Then they go out, they have to come back to class, they haven't passed. You know, there are all those problems around health that are encountered. And even the facilities themselves, there was a school where a teacher said, I cannot implement the physical education part of life orientation because I have I'm a graduate in physical education. I know that these conditions are not conducive for this learner to do exercises. The area is rocky, the rooms are not, you know, all those things. So when we introduce all these good things, do we look at what we have and come up with measures to assist? I'll stop there. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Linda. Before maybe I give just last question, DJ. The last time when the department presented, you promised that as from November, the department will be distributing a toolkit to the grade R. If we can just get a progress report, because today is the 11th of November, at least something should have happened.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Let me just pick up on that final one. I do understand the report I received, in fact, this week was that the toolkits have been completed. They are going out. Our commitment is that together with the workbooks, all of these will be provided to schools by the beginning of the first term next year. So they're not intended for use this year, but the toolkits, that's both the reading toolkit, but now it's been supplemented with workbooks, it's been supplemented with lesson plans for teachers. All of those, I believe, are on track for delivery at the beginning of the year, but perhaps I'll get confirmation on that and feed it through to you in terms of that, but certainly that's there. I don't think in many schools we'd want to be delivering at this time of year. Many schools don't have those safe facilities to store these things, and therefore we'd rather see them going out at the beginning of the year together with the rest of the materials for grade R.
While on that issue, you remember you made a promise that members would be given, you know, just a set, because as members we are expected also to adopt schools, you know, so that we should see what are they doing. They must report that they have adopted schools and monitor those schools.
Chair, we'll certainly make a note of that, and I will bring it to you. The toolkit, of course, is a very big box. I'm not promising every member they're going to get a full toolkit, but I think what we were indicating is the sort of things you should expect the school to have, and therefore you should be able to ask. I will certainly follow that up, Chair, and I will provide it to you as a matter of urgency, because we would love you to be involved, particularly at the opening of schools next year, and in monitoring that kind of thing. Madam Chair, then just to take from the top, the quality of school nutrition food, I did caution you when I reported that, as I say, it's a fairly small amount that we do spend, and it doesn't buy a lot, but I think your points are well taken, and obviously that's why we've tried to encourage the school garden approach, because it does obviously supplement the kind of things that might be delivered by suppliers, etc., the biscuits, the bread, and that sort of thing. But, Chair, I think one of the things that we are exploring, and I think in the next short while we'll see some development, is in this whole field of what are termed micronutrients. You know, it's very easy to supplement mealy-meal with your vitamin A, vitamin D, your iron, your iodine, those sort of things that are very often what the children are missing. As you say, the SAMP doesn't provide it. It fills your stomach, but that's all. But to provide a few added vitamins and minerals to those is very cost-effective, and I think, Chair, we'd be looking at those more and more, so that even if it is, as you say, only cabbage, at least we know within that cabbage there are sufficient nutrients to ensure that the child is getting properly fed. But Ms. Ndebele might want to add to that as well. Look, the issue of the special schools and who gets in, I think, is a continuing problem, and it rightly has been raised. We introduced 2 years ago to schools a document called SIAS, S-I-A-S. It's a screening, identification and support document. And this is intended for ordinary teachers who wouldn't have been trained in remedial work or identifying special needs, but helps them in just dealing with their learners, and in particular to be able to identify those who do either need special counseling or perhaps special education of some sort. And we're hoping that with the implementation of the CS document, we will get literally those who most need special education into those facilities which can best provide it. But in the end, those will take time to change. And I think you're right, there are many children with special needs who aren't being catered for in the right way because of that malrepresentation. It's an ongoing thing that we have to deal with. The issue brought to you by Science and Technology around graduate unemployment. Madam Chair, I'm going to try and duck that question and suggest that you might want to invite the Department of Higher Education and Training to come and talk to you about that. I know it is a concern that they share as well, and perhaps they would want to take you through some steps that they are looking at there. And while I'm on that one, Chair, can I also ask that the question about the new universities in Mpumalanga and Northern Cape be deferred to that meeting? I think they would be best placed to discuss their expansion plans in that regard, the Minister or the DG. The school safety one and the violence one is, as you rightly say, an ongoing problem that we're addressing. As I say, there are two elements to it. The first thing you try to do is provide the minimum infrastructure for a school, so it's got a fence, it's got a security guard, it's got cameras and those sort of things. But Chair, we've also got to recognize that in the end, that still doesn't make for a safe school. If you recall this very unfortunate incident in the Western Cape where the school principal was shot, that school had every bit of security equipment you could ever imagine, including security cameras, of course. Those cameras got turned off 20 minutes before that shooting incident happened. So there is no record of it. And what that tells you is that these facilities are not on their own enough. The safest schools are those where communities have taken ownership of those schools and protected them. And in fact, we still have many schools in this country, very good schools with very good facilities and resources, that actually have no fences at all. And the reason that they're safe is that communities are looking after them. One of the best examples we've got, I think, is the one in Ivory Park. There's a school there in the middle of the squatter camp. There's no fence or anything. It's got the most wonderful computer lab in there, and I promise you there is nothing touched in that school. If someone touched it, I hate to say what the community would do, but you can be sure that that equipment would be back in the school the next morning without doubt. So it's a twofold issue that we've got to work. We have to do what we can, but communities also need to, in a sense, do what they can to ensure that our schools are also safe. But it's an ongoing one. The data about matriculants, I'm sure we can provide that. It's not easy because someone matriculates from a school, there's no guarantee they stay in that area, so you know, it's not going to be that easy to track them, but certainly we can provide you, I think, with people who are there. And then, of course, the very sticky issue of teachers being counsellors. Now, that's a very simple issue where that person is elected to a full-time position in local government because they have to resign. There's no question. They resign as teachers, they become counsellors, mayors, whatever. The problem arises where, of course, it's a part-time appointment. You're a part-time counsellor. And one of the difficulties is, of course, it raises a very serious power relationship. Technically, that teacher should, of course, ask permission to leave the school if they have to for a particular business. But, of course, they're a city councillor. They're going to kind of ask the principal, do you mind if I leave? They're going to say to the principal, this is my job and my responsibility and I'm going. Yeah? And the principal says, oh, what can I say? Kind of. Now, let me be honest. As the education department, we said we don't think teachers should be allowed to stand for local government election. Political parties rightly have said, hello, if you do that, then there is no local government in rural areas because it's actually mostly teachers who are local government in those areas. So, really, we need the assistance of political parties here. In preference, and I do understand that the ruling party certainly did take a preference position to say, if possible, don't nominate teachers for local government. But you can't make a blanket ban. The Constitution says anyone can stand for any government position. You can't ban teachers from doing it, but it does create an enormous problem in that school, and as I say, the control over that one. So I don't have any solutions on it, except again to say communities need to think very carefully. Maybe when it comes in 2011 to local government elections, we should put the word out that you should never vote for your local teacher. Yeah, but I don't know if we're allowed to do that.
No. Maybe
happy to face you on that. That thing is still under discussion on the ruling party.
I do understand, and I'm very happy to hear that.
I hope the outcome is the right one. The question about kids up and the resources, look, it doesn't surprise me necessarily that schools and even districts didn't know the name Kids Up. But what they should hopefully have seen is that additional resources have come into their poor schools. Now, those resources don't have Kids Up written on them. They are just resources, books, etc., that come into the schools. So I would hope that someone somewhere in the hierarchy does become aware that this school is a beneficiary of Kids Up. But as I say, it wouldn't be essential for the school itself to know that. The school should just know that it is benefiting, and that indeed should be enough for it. But we can provide you with more information, but I think it's right that this Kids Up is really just something that we deal with. That's our notion of affirmative action, and that's it, yeah? I'm not sure about, did you say an international exam? What's the question about the exam? Was that the national assessment? Okay. Mm-hmm. National assessment, certainly we're conducting. No, look, while we at a national level collect the aggregates, and that clearly is important for us, we do share obviously with provinces where they are performing, but in fact we have now provided that feedback to every single school to say, this is where your learners did well in these parts of the question, this is where they didn't do well. So on reading, for example, they might be very good at listening, and on listening skills, for example, they might not be as strong on certain other skills around literacy. So that feedback is going direct to schools and teachers, and I think we could give you some examples of that sort of feedback that has helped schools to understand where they might be going wrong. Anything like this, any assessment, has to at the same time be a developmental tool. It has to help teachers to get better and not just hit them with a stick and say you're not good enough or anything like that. So hopefully that's happening, but if you're aware of anything that's not, we'll look at that. As I say, the new universities, I'm not going to go down that road. I certainly don't have the money in the new Department of Basic Education for that. Maybe higher education does. The issue of the peer counselling, Ms. Ndebele, you will deal with that, thanks very much. You did ask about teachers, and to a large extent we have said that teachers, like any other member of the public, must use either private or public health facilities. There's no special arrangements around teachers for any illness or disease. They look after themselves. But I am happy to say that we've got a very strong partnership with the teacher unions that, together with some international funding, we have put together a PCTA program for teachers that is running in all provinces, where some teachers have said, the leading member of the community, I really can't go to the health clinic and people see me there. So in fact, these PCTA offices have been set up in more discreet places, and teachers are able to go and get what they need there. So that's a bit of a status thing, I think, that we're working for. The issue of girls' participation, I don't think it was a case of not being budgeted for. In fact, Chair, the 2008 results showed us very clearly that in fact not only are girls staying on in school more than boys, but in fact they're doing better than boys if you look at the matric results of 2008. So I think in a sense the priority that we understood about trying to ensure more girls are staying and doing these subjects, in fact the imperative is not as strong, it's largely happening anyway. There's some subjects perhaps more like your technology and engineering that are not there, but certainly in terms of maths and science, there are many girls taking them and, as I say, certainly doing well on it. The issue of the ICT feasibility study, a bit of a technical report that if you're going to go into a public-private partnership, which we thought we might be doing following that feasibility study, we might thought that we want to borrow money from private sector in order to get all schools with computers and ABC. In order to do that, there are first certain technical steps that one has to follow with Treasury. We've simply said now we're not following that particular route, so we don't need to take those technical steps. We're following a different route around the provision of ICTs to schools. Inclusive education, I think it was just a comment about the curriculum adaptation there, and certainly we have adapted both the curriculum but also the assessment tools for special schools, and they have ability to use those adaptations in different ways. Chair, on the admin aspect, I can confirm that 100% of our senior management staff did declare their financial interest in time, so that indeed has been complied with, and we do indeed have a very rigorous program of people being given permission to do outside work. Let me say that while we've taken the general approach that discourages people doing work outside the department, and certainly a strong approach in terms of people having business interests outside the department, we do need to recognize that we have a lot of very senior professionals in the department. And for example, if I may use Dr. Makhanan Chechi, he happens to be an external examiner for UNISA in the area of the master's degree in management. Now, that's professional expertise. I would hate to say, no, don't do this. It's a contribution to the education system. So, yes, I've given him permission to do it. So I don't think he earns very much for it, I'm afraid. But as I say, it's work that he does, and we think it's good work that we do. But certainly nothing is allowed that takes people away from their office, takes time away, and certainly nothing allowed that has any conflict of interest in this regard. So, again, I think full compliance there. I have to indicate that we submit those financial interest declarations to the Public Service Commission. I understand that those are, in fact, confidential records, so I can't offer to bring those to you at this stage. Regrettably, you can ask the Public Service Commission if they would like to release them. I certainly have nothing to hide, and I don't believe our department does. On the question about the post-provisioning norm for rural education, I can already say that the post-provisioning norm does privilege small schools. Small schools do get an additional allocation of staff, but in the end, it's never enough. As you say, where you've got six grades, you're likely to find probably two, maybe three teachers. It simply isn't enough to manage a school. And that's back to our earlier point about these things just being educationally inefficient, unless you're going to really give them so many teachers that then you have to take away and increase the post-provisioning norms for other schools. That is just not on a system level sustainable either. So we have to look at that. But I would invite you to look at the new norms and standards around school size. Certainly we have said no school should be below, I think it's 50 learners, and no school should go above, I think, 1,200 learners. So if we're outside of those parameters, we need to ask what is happening and why is something different not being done. Yeah? Again, the issue of university students, I assume, getting their funds late, I think you need to take that up with the Department of Higher Education and Training and with the National Student Financial Aid Scheme. But I can confirm from our side that the day that the budget is approved and on 1st of April when that budget is given to us, we transfer those funds to the National Student Financial Aid Scheme. There's no reason for them to be holding those payments back in any way. Students should get that money, and we know they need it certainly as soon as possible. There's no delay on that one. The issue of the Code of Conduct for schools, we did put out a sort of template Code of Conduct for all schools, and we were planning to monitor that. I think our distraction in that particular year was around the SGB elections which were held, so a lot of the effort and resources that were available for school governance in fact went on to ensuring that we had proper school governing body elections in that year, and I think we would have to pick up again on the code of conduct issue. And then the report on the teachers, the maths and science teachers, we can certainly make it available to you. It's a fascinating report, because what it actually tells us is we have enough maths and science teachers in the country. The trouble is, they're not teaching maths and science. A lot of them are either in school, they like being in that school, they don't need to, they're enough math teachers in the school, so they say, all right, I'll do a bit of English and history instead. And that's a real problem, because I have no authority, as government and provinces have none either, to say to that teacher, hold on, you're a qualified math teacher. There's a school down the road that needs a math teacher. Let's move you down there. I can't do that. I have to get the permission of this teacher, I have to get the permission of that school, and until that happens, those teachers get locked up in these schools not teaching maths. So we have, in a sense, an inefficient utilization of our teaching staff. Enough maths and science teachers, but because I can't deploy them in a way that we need to, and to be honest, in a way that all of us who started teaching started. We were never asked where we wanted to go teaching. We were told, ask the school, go and teach. Yeah? No one asked the school, no one asked you. Now, we've got to find, I think, an improved system where we are able to deploy the scarce resources, particularly things like maths and science teachers, in a more effective way. But we will give you that report, certainly. The issue of whole school evaluation, ma'am, let me say firstly, I'm extremely encouraged by the fact that Mpumalanga is doing so much work around school monitoring and evaluation. And you say it's duplication, and I say, all right, that clearly shouldn't happen. But I would be more worried if you told me that nothing was happening rather than that you told me that all of these things were happening and schools were continually being visited and monitored. I think that's quite exciting. But let me just respond and say that part of the task of Need You that they're working on at the moment is to evaluate all the current instruments that we have, to look at the overlaps, contradictions, gaps, etc., and to come up then with new instruments which would in some way be the single instrument that we would use to try and ensure that that's happening. So please, we'll watch that. I certainly wasn't aware of the special Mpumalanga initiative. We'll have to factor that one in as well. The comments about physical education and infrastructure, you know, I'm very concerned about the view of that so-called physical education graduate, that I can't do this thing unless I've got a nice running track. And you know, yes, of course, we all want that. It's the same for teaching physical science. You know, unless I've got a proper laboratory, I'm not going to teach. You can't do that. We're in a developmental state. Children need physical education. They need science. You do what you can with what you've got. And in all honesty, take them outside, do a couple of jumping jacks, bending, press-ups, whatever they might be. I take your point about facilities to wash and change, and probably those would be more important for me. But the idea that you can't teach until everything is absolutely perfect, I think is something we've got to challenge quite strongly and say to that person, look, with all your skills, make something happen. You know, that's why you've been trained, not to sit back and make complaints, but to ensure that you can do your work in some way. So let me comment on that. Ms. Ndebele, over to you, Tom.
Just to add on that, I think what we will do, certainly by the end of the week, is to send you, we're in the process of training physical education teachers. This government sent a few educators to Cuba to go and learn PE, and one of them is working in the department and is doing the training for us. But I just want to share the material that we're using to show the things that teachers can do to teach PE. But also that PE is not just only physical training, it's also about education. But we'll share, I'll get the director here to send you a pack, because we're doing that together with Mr. Price, that program. And it's got examples, teachers can look at it, and it's got examples of the kinds of activity. However, it doesn't detract from the issue of infrastructure, because I think it's important that there is infrastructure for school sports broadly. And around the issue of nutrition, it's the one thing that bothers me the most, the quality of food. Part of it is the amount that we receive in per learner. It's not enough. But what we have found, and honorable members can check, where the money goes directly to the school and the school is able to purchase from local trade, they normally have a variety of things to provide. But where the procurement is done centrally, whether it's the province, then it tends to be the same or the soya. And obviously, HODs are worried that if they delegate the money to the schools, the issues of accountability, etc. Mm-hmm. But the principle is that where the money, whether it's cooperatives, etc., where they do the feeding themselves. KwaZulu-Natal, we've got a number, over 400 women cooperatives that are part of the school nutrition program. They provide a variety of menus. But the last thing is that with GAME, we're doing a recipe book for schools that they can see what kind of things they could do with. And it will be ready end of January, I think, if we keep to the time frame, and we can provide that. But it's something that otherwise it defeats the purpose of having the school nutrition program. The last one is around HIV and AIDS. It's a pity the honorable member is not in. The program that she was... The program that you are talking about is a program of USAID, which is focusing on peer educators in the four provinces. But there is a process in the department of the review of the conditional grant of HIV and AIDS, so that it includes care and support, it includes support to teachers, it looks at prevention. So it's a comprehensive program, not just focusing on just life skills, but also on the overall approach to HIV and AIDS.
Thank you, ma'am. I think we have exhausted members that interacted, and PG, I was
hoping to hear other voices, but that this is on top of the issues. But let me say, lastly, just take this opportunity maybe to thank the department for availing themselves. And you know, the issue that Honorable Boroto raised around physical education, I'm a little bit disturbed. Maybe from the side of the ruling party, you said that this is one of the issues that should go back to school, because we used to have physical education. So we can't see now why do we have to have come up with this reason while this thing were happening before. So on that note, I would like just to thank the department. And I think that we need more interaction. And DG, I think that the next time we'll have to separate the issues, because, you know, we are dealing with higher education and basic education at the same time. And it doesn't really give us, as members, more information, because you'll be touching there. I think when we come here and separate it, then it will be better for us as members also. But let me just thank you, and the meeting's done.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Can I just say that this is the last time we'd report as the Department of Education. So in future, certainly the invitations would come either to the Department of Basic Education or to the Department of Higher Education. So I think it's a response to that. Thanks, Minister. Thanks, sir.
Thank you.
I'm late for a meeting with the minister. That's why I'm nothing to reflect on your ambitions.
I was worried when I heard that the DG had resigned, and maybe it was the moving from basic whatever.
Yeah.
Hey, it worried me.
Thank you. Thank you.